Okay, today's September the 12th, 2016, and I just wanted to give you all an update about what's been going on lately. I was invited by the number one alternative talk radio show host in New Zealand, whose name is Vinnie Eastwood, to appear on a show, and of course I accepted, and within a couple weeks, I was supposed to go on the show in a couple weeks, and then like almost literally that day or the next day, I just got completely slammed with some kind of cold or virus or flu, and I mean, I couldn't hardly talk. I mean, I was having troubles with my breathing for you know, most of those 2 weeks, and I couldn't hear out of like my left ear for almost 3 weeks. I mean, I could hear, but it was like, you know how your ears pop. And it was just like 90%. I couldn't hear out of that ear, so I was having a lot of problems. So I told him that I didn't, it might be better for us to delay the show, and I was going to go on anyway. And then at the last minute, he said he wasn't feeling good either. So I just never materialized, and it would have been a really good opportunity because. You know, he puts his shows up on YouTube and they get like 250,000 views within a few weeks or whatever. And, when I had when I interviewed the guy that met the Demiurge, it took, like a year, and I just got like maybe a little over 50,000 hits for that interview. So anyway, it's something that'll probably happen, and then I was going to do a follow-up interview with him, the guy that met the Demiurge during his near-death experience, and we were going to do it for the next weekend, and all of a sudden Austin just gets slammed with seriously heavy rainfall and floods, and I mean, it rained here in Austin almost every day for 3 weeks straight, and so that didn't happen. So, it's like when somebody's psyched up and ready to do something, and then, the rug gets pulled out from them. So anyway, I think it's pretty much the Archons are in full force trying to keep the word from getting out, but it is what it is. So anyway, I thought I'm feeling a lot better now, so I thought I'd give you some update. I've ran across some really interesting material lately that confirms much of what I've been saying, and so I'm going to try to share that with you here, and then also give you the gist of what I was going to say on Vinny's podcast show, too. So anyway, I received an email from someone who validates elements of the interviewee's experience, the guy who met the Demiurge, and so he wrote me, and he said, anyway, as I read your friend's story, I found myself recalling various dreams I've had in my life about pretty much his whole experience, but in disjointed pieces. At the time that I had them, I pretty much just dismissed them as normal creative dreams and didn't place much value on them. I just thought they were interesting thought creations of mine and probably the kinds of things most other people dream about when they sleep. I was just a young human child. I've never actually heard anyone mention the same dreams, though. Now that I'm reading about someone else who experienced the same things with very good detail and cohesively putting all the moments together into a storyline, I find myself zoning out constantly now in order to try to dig deeply into my memories 30-plus years ago to recall them all and other dreams that I had that could be significant in order to understand these spiritual processes. Now I see those dreams in a totally different light. They were spirit memories I was recalling while asleep, I guess, or quite significant astral traveling. But it felt so weird back then, dreaming like I was an adult when I was a young kid. Speaking of scary, that Demiurge, just as your friend described him, can be frightening, let me tell you. That serious expression, not angry, not passionate, not excited, just as serious as you could ever imagine a face to look, and those flames he has for eyes, literally flames. I woke up one time right as at the end of one fascinating dream, seemed to get interrupted with a close-up of his face. At the time, I had no idea who that character was, just some strange, scary guy I saw in my dreams at least a few times, and that particular time was rather startling. Another time, I recall him standing in front of a huge spaceship window and maybe like a whole wall of controls and levers on the wall on one side of the window, I think. I feel like I had that dream a number of times as a young child. I remember it. Such a strange, random thing to dream about for me. I had no idea why I kept seeing this in my dreams. I remember going back there as if I was sneaking around, exploring it at times too, when the scary guy wasn't around. I was in that place so many times. It's hard for me now to remember all the specifics, though. I feel like I returned to that place many times after some of the most amazing dreams I had. It was like time traveling every time I went to bed. I was in the future, in the past, on other worlds, in other dimensions, as all kinds of creatures and different people, all over the place. My dreams were incredible. It's a shame because it feels so important now that I wish I had my mom help me to record them into a journal at the time. It was also vitally important. I feel like I have had many experiences in space as an energy orb type being. If I still have those dreams, I just don't remember the dreams now when I wake. Maybe I've become too anchored or consumed by this material existence. Maybe my light has dimmed through my life of suffering. Maybe the demiurge finally figured out how to control me, or at least how to block or suppress some of my spiritual will. I guess I gave him more trouble than most. A shame, though, because the dream experiences were just so absolutely incredible. Like I said, though, some may have never happened and have been completely created by my imagination. But I definitely remember those moments that your friend described. His story is your best story. At least the visual descriptions of his story are accurate to me. They resonate with my recollections. There's something to this. I believe you're on the right path by focusing on that man's NDE visions and valuing his story. Let me say something else, though. I remember seeing another figure as well, in addition to and similar to the demiurges described by your friend. This one was maybe taller and younger looking. I think he was bald with a big bushy black beard. He was in a different dream, but he still had the bronze, golden-like skin and flame eyes. That one was not in the same place. I thought I remembered more of a brighter Greek-Roman kind of area with whitish pillars and steps and him walking along, rather than a dim spaceship. Forgive my spotty recollection. These dreams happened like 30 years ago. I wonder if he was a son or direct progeny of the demiurge, or maybe a demiurge of a different world altogether. I really have no idea, but there was a resemblance, and he was definitely humanoid in body shape, too. He was actually the one that I saw very close up at the end of one of my dreams. I was flying around some huge object, and then I flew over some hair, and then all of a sudden realized it was a black beard, and that guy's face took over my sight, and he was just glaring at me, and I woke up. Those eyes, flaming eyes, it's not a sight you can easily forget, even if you saw it in a dream 30 years ago. End quote. So, yeah, he wrote me about that account, and I sent it to my friend, and, you know, he thought maybe we were planning on doing the follow-up interview that we had talked about after the first interview. And he thought it might be a good idea if we had this guy come on and talk about his dream. But he didn't want to do it. I guess he just really hates doing interviews, and I guess I can't blame him. I can relate to that. And I'm going to try to still maybe just get him come on for a few minutes and just, you know, relay something similar to what I just read to you. But he's very reluctant to do it. He doesn't think it would make a difference whether people would believe it anymore or not. You know, it's just because somebody came on and said they had dreams that were similar. So, but here's the interesting thing in my mind is that if people are having dreams and the demiurge is appearing to them, and of course most people don't remember those dreams, or maybe they're covered with a false memory implant or some kind of cover up, you know, but it's possible that, you know, we spend 1/3 of our lives at night, sleeping and dreaming. And it's, you know, maybe it's possible that we're getting reprogrammed, or they're trying to reprogram us. And if, you know, especially if, you know, most people aren't going to remember their dreams like he did. He remembered many things as a very, very young child that most of us would say it's impossible or or can't be the case, but yet he claims it is. So anyway, I think it, from that aspect alone, it's worth exploring more fully. So we'll see. Another thing, I think the Demiurge might be mentioned in the book of Revelations, because the man who met the Demiurge, his description is pretty close to this description in Revelations 1:12. And Revelations 1:12 says, quote, "And in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in his strength." End quote. So that could very well be the same being that my friend was describing. Another really important researcher, I think I'd read a couple of his books a long, long time ago, but his name is Stanislav Grof, and he's a researcher into psychedelics and the effects of hallucinogens, and he's analyzed like 4,000 to 6,000 different experiences, and he had a book in 1998, which I just discovered, called The Cosmic Game, Explorations of the Frontiers of Human Consciousness, and which he related the account of an experiencer who experienced being one of four demiurgic powers. And I'll read that to you in just a second. But Stanislav in his book said, quote, "Since the divine play, the cosmic drama, is unimaginable without individual protagonists, without distinct separate entities, the existence of evil is absolutely essential for the creation of the world as we know it. This understanding is in basic agreement with the notion found in some Christian mystical scriptures, according to which the fallen angel Lucifer, literally light-bearer, as a representative of polarities, is seen as a demiurgic figure. He takes humanity on a fantastic journey into the world of matter. Approaching this problem from another perspective, we can say that, in the last analysis, evil and suffering are based on a false perception of reality, particularly the belief of sentient beings in their separate individual self. This insight forms an essential part of the Buddhist doctrine of anatta or anatman, no self." So here's a section on, it's called Creative Play of the Demiurges, and I guess it's based on the account of someone who had maybe a psychedelic experience. But he writes, "The insights into the nature and dynamics of the cosmic game do not have to emerge on the level of the supreme creative principle. Gale, a minister who participated in our training program for professionals at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, had in her psychedelic session an interesting sequence that portrayed cosmogony as a competitive creative game of four demiurgic superhuman entities. Although her experience is very unusual, since it involves several demiurgic beings rather than one creative principle, I will include it here. It illustrates with exceptional clarity many of the issues related to the problem of incarnation of spiritual beings and the taboo against knowing who you are. Here is the corresponding excerpt from her session. I found myself in a dimension that seemed to lie beyond space and time as we know it. What comes to my mind when I think about it now is the concept of hyperspace used by modern physicists. However, such a technical term would not describe the profound feeling of sacredness, the awesome sense of numinosity associated with my experience. I realized that I was a suprahuman being of immense proportions, possibly one that transcended all limitations, or one that existed before any limitations were known. I did not have any form, being, just pure consciousness with superb intelligence suspended in absolute space. Although there was no source of light there, I cannot say I was in complete darkness. I shared this space with three other beings. Although they were purely abstract and amorphous, like myself, I could clearly feel their separate presence and communicate with them in a complex telepathic fashion. We amused each other by various brilliant intellectual games. Fireworks of extraordinary ideas were being thrown back and forth. The complexity, intricacy, and level of imagination involved in these games by far surpassed anything known among humans. It was all pure entertainment. L'art pour l'art, since in the form we were, none of it had any practical implications. I have to think in this context about whales who float in the ocean with their enormous brains and are endowed with intelligence that matches or surpasses ours. Since nature does not create and maintain organs and functions that are not being used, the mental activity of the cetaceans has to be comparable to that of humans. Yet, because of their anatomy, they have only minimal capacity to give any tangible physical expression to what is going on in their minds. I once read a speculation of a researcher who suggested that the whales may be spending most of their time entertaining each other using their amazing voices that carry in the ocean over distances of hundreds of miles. Do they tell each other stories and communicate artistic creations? Do they have philosophical dialogues or play sophisticated games? Or are they like Indian or Tibetan yogis who, in their deep meditations, in the solitude of their caves and cells, experience connection with the entire history of the cosmos and other realities? After this introduction, describing the general ambience and context of her experience and reflecting on the disembodied existence as a purely spiritual being, Gail focused on the part of her session that has immediate relevance for our discussion about the taboo against knowing who we are. One of the beings came up with an intriguing idea. It suggested that it would be possible to create a game involving a reality with many different creatures of various size and forms. They would appear to be dense and solid and exist in a world filled with objects of different shapes, textures, and consistencies. The beings would come into existence, evolve, have complex interactions and adventures with each other, and then cease to exist. There would be groups of creatures of various orders, each existing in two forms, male and female, that would complement each other and participate in reproduction. This reality would be bound by distinct space and time coordinates. Time would show a mandatory flow from the past through the present to the future, and later events would appear to be caused by the preceding ones. There would be vast historical periods, each different from the others. One would have to travel to get from one place to another, and there would be many different ways to do it. A variety of rigid limitations, rules, and laws would govern all the events in this world, as it is with all the games. Entering this reality and assuming different roles in it would provide exquisite entertainment of a very unique type. The three spiritual beings were intrigued, but incredulous, and expressed serious doubts about the suggested project. As exciting as it sounded, it seemed unlikely that it could be implemented. How could an unlimited spiritual being existing in the world of all possibilities be made to believe that it is confined to a solid body of a strange shape, with a head, trunk, and extremities, and that it critically depends on the ingestion of other dead creatures and the presence of a gas called oxygen? How could it be convinced that it has a limited intellectual capacity and that its ability to perceive is constrained by the range of something like sensory organs? It seemed too fantastic to be seriously considered. In what follows, Gail describes how the demiurgic beings resolved the problem. A heated intellectual exchange ensued. The originator of this plan responded to all our objections, insisting that the project was perfectly feasible. She was convinced that sufficient complexity and intriguing nature of the script, consistent association of specific situations with compelling experiences, and careful covering of all the loopholes was all that was necessary. It would trap the participant into an intricate net of illusions and trick him or her into believing in the reality of the game. We were getting increasingly fascinated by all the possibilities and finally became convinced that this unusual project was viable. We agreed to enter the game of incarnation, excited by the promise of extraordinary adventures in consciousness. This experience has somehow resolved whatever concerns I have ever had regarding the matter of karma. It left me with a firm conviction that I am, in essence, a spiritual being, and that the only way I could have possibly gotten involved in the cosmic drama was through a free decision. The choice to incarnate involves voluntary acceptance of a large number of limitations, rules, and laws, as it always does when we decide to play a game. From this perspective, it does not make sense to blame anybody for anything that happens in our life. The fact that, on a higher level, we have a free choice whether or not we enter the cosmic game creates a meta-framework that redefines everything that occurs within it. End quote. So there is Stanislav Grof, who's maybe the foremost researcher into psychedelics and hallucinogens that I'm aware of. He's based on over between 4,000 and 6,000 different cases that he's studied, and he writes a book called The Cosmic Game, and he actually mentions demiurges in the book. So there's something I didn't even know about until now. Here's another really good researcher named William Buhlmann, and he studies out-of-body experiences, and he's got a few books that are just really, really outstanding. So I want to read a few quotes from his books that are just mind-blowing, in my opinion. But he has had many out-of-body experiences himself, and he conducted a survey on out-of-body experiences with over 16,000 responses. So in his book, Adventures in the Afterlife, I just now got these two books over the weekend, and I'd had his book, Adventures Beyond the Body, I think it was called, many, many years ago when I was researching all this stuff, and it was outstanding too. But I just found out about these. He says, in Adventures in the Afterlife, he says, quote, "It's important to learn how to consciously move and lock your awareness within any individual energy environment. You unknowingly did this when you entered the first non-physical reality immediately after your death. When you embraced this construct and accepted it as your own, you became one with it. In doing so, you unconsciously locked yourself in a structured consensus thought matrix created by a group of like-minded souls." He also says, quote, "To become an effective spiritual traveler is vital to develop your flexibility of consciousness. You must learn how to shift your state of awareness without becoming attached to the energies that dominate a given reality." He says, "This is basic soul travel, lateral motion of consciousness in a structured consensus reality. You can use the energy signature of any familiar location as your target. The key is to completely focus, know, and flow. It's essential to lock your awareness into a specific energy environment or your perception will become unstable. This skill is critical when you're attempting multiple reality jumps." He says, "Yes, all these things are your projections. Now you can see how easy it is for untrained souls to become completely trapped within their own thought forms. This is a common problem for billions of souls dwelling in the physical and astral projections. Few souls are aware of the creative power of their own thoughts. The self-created manifestations of forms make for convincing illusions in all dimensions. Many humans remain imprisoned in this labyrinth of the mind," end quote. In the book, The Secret of the Soul, and I highly recommend, you know, getting both these books, or at least he's got lectures online too that you can listen to, but he says, quote, "Many people are relieved and overjoyed to discover that they really do continue to exist after death, and as a result, gladly accept the first non-physical reality they experience as their, quote, new spiritual home. However, there is one very serious problem with this comforting scenario that few are aware of and no one addresses. You have just accepted and adapted to a thought consensus environment on the astral plane. You have just accepted a reflection of spirit instead of the true essence of it. You have done what billions have done before you. You have merged your consciousness with a non-physical reality far from your true spiritual home. By doing so, you essentially guarantee the continuation of your form-based existence and your reincarnation. The end result is that most people accept the denser spiritual realities of the physical plane as their new home. They settle for and adapt to the physical-like areas of the astral plane because these environments are familiar and comfortable. Thus, they chain themselves to the astral realms of form and substance, and the ancient cycle of rebirth is maintained and assured," end quote. He also says, quote, "I'm often asked what I will do when I take my final breath. This is a critically important question that too few people ask themselves these days. My answer is this. I will demand to experience my higher self, my spiritual essence. I am not content to simply go to the light. I am not content to accept past acquaintances and comfortable surroundings as my new reality. In fact, I am not content to settle for any form-based reality as my spiritual home. I absolutely know there is so much more available beyond the realms of form. There exist dimensions of magnificent living light simply waiting for us. All we need to do is awaken and accept their reality. Two powerful truths are apparent. First, all form is but a reflection of pure spirit. Second, we are not helpless victims of an external force that dictates or directs our reality in our lives. We are bestowed with the power of free will and the ability to take spiritual action. Why would you settle for a pale reflection of reality when the pure realms of spirit are always present? He says, let us begin to take responsibility not only for our physical life, but our afterlife as well. We determine the realities that we accept and co-create. So, from this moment on, let us be aware and choose well. End quote. He says, all dimensions occupy the same time and space. They are separated by their individual frequency and resulting density. As we move in toward the energy source, each heaven becomes progressively more thought responsive. Multiple heavens exist within each dimension, created by the group consciousness of the inhabitants. End quote. He also says, the sooner we awaken to and experience in the interdimensional path within us, the sooner we will begin beyond our animal bodies and embrace our unlimited abilities to fully experience our spiritual essence. Our spiritual growth and evolution are directly related to our ability to navigate the multidimensional path within us, end quote. And this last quote I want to read is, he says, everything seen and unseen is a form of energy, and there is no escaping the subtle energy creations of our own mind. We must conquer our personal addictions and attachments, for these are the anchors that hold us to the destiny of form and matter, end quote. So, yeah, there's a lot of things he says in his books that I agree with. He's, for the most part, he's spot on in my mind. Talks a lot about the need for spiritual evolution, and I'm not sure I buy into that trap. And at times he kind of contradicts that also himself. But by and large, he's definitely worth reading. So this is not from the nderf.org website, which is where most of my quotes on the near-death experience come from. But this one is from Joe McMonagall, who's a well-known remote viewer. He says, quote, at the time, it's just something you have to deal with. I was not able to assimilate the event for many years. I just had the experience, and I was walking around the experience and not knowing how to assimilate it in any way. For a long time, I was absolutely convinced that the white light was God. I'm not convinced of that now. The experience is still just as real in my mind as the day it happened, but I've since had a second near-death experience when I had a heart attack at age 39, right after retirement from the Army. In my second experience, I was fully prepared to go to the light again, to go where I knew was home, and I was not allowed to. I was allowed only to see it, but I was not allowed to enjoy it. So in the second experience, this confused me. It created a huge philosophic problem for me, because by being able to see the light and not going to it, it showed me that the light had edges. My definition of God is that God cannot be a finite being. God can't have edges. So it created a huge philosophic problem for me, and I processed that for many years. The answer I've sort of accepted, that I'm comfortable with now, is that what I believe the light is what we are in totality when we're no longer a physical being. We're pure energy beings, and we're created in the image and likeness of God. But that isn't God. It's the reason why we feel so complete and so whole. End quote. And my friend who I interviewed, and, you know, we go out and we'll eat every couple of weeks or whatever, play some tennis sometimes, and I read that quote to him, and he agreed that he doesn't feel that the light that he went to is God either. I know during the interview he addressed it as, you know, he said, thank you, God, but he doesn't feel that it's God either. But it'll be interesting if we have another interview. He has a lot more to say. It's you know, he's got most of it in the first interview, of course. But I know that Well, I guess I don't want to put any words in those mouth. Anyway, we'll go on with what I was going to talk about here, and I guess it's pretty much what I wanted to cover in the Vinny Eastman interview that did not materialize due to my illness, but hopefully will. So basically, the theory of my website trickedbythelight.com is that life is a reality TV show or some form of entertainment, whether it's a drama, play, movie, or a game. And the plot is that humans are slaves imprisoned on Earth by interdimensional beings, and humans are being farmed as a source of energy or sustenance. At death, souls are lured through a tunnel, most likely associated with the moon, to the false white light, which very well may be the astral sun, where our memories are bleached or dyed, and our souls are recycled, and we are reincarcerated. I mean reincarnated. We humans like to think we're at the top of the food chain, but isn't it possible that our energy or electricity is being farmed by astral entities or parasites just outside our field of awareness? I'd like to say that I do not claim to have all the answers or know the absolute truth. I'm just a researcher who is exploring the possibility that the light we are all told about may not be the best option. Everyone should weigh the evidence for themselves and come to their own conclusion. So basically, we are slaves on this prison planet. We're born as helpless babies with total amnesia. We learn by mimicking the behavior of our parents and society. We're told what to do, you know, behave or go to your room. If you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding. You go to school to be indoctrinated and told what to believe. And the first thing we learn is how to spell words to pronounce a sentence of terms. You know, it's like prison terms, a sentence of prison terms. Anyway, you behave or you got to go stand in the corner and serve detention, and you're told to get a job, you know, later on so you can pay your landlord his rent, and, you know, you got to be productive so you can, you know, pay taxes, you know, be a good little slave, be productive, get married, have children. So we're given the illusion of freedom by voting for either a false left or a false right paradigm, which are both really controlled by the same rich elite entities. Go to church and be good sheep, or you're going to burn in hell forever. And you give them money, and they'll tell you the word of God. In Catholicism, you're born a no good sinner, and you need saving. And in the Eastern religions, you know, you got the karma police or the lords of karma that demand you must repay for your bad deeds in the next life, even though you don't know or remember what you're being punished for. So how can you even learn? We have a very limited free will. I mean, most, you know, you don't get whatever you want here. I mean, most are trapped doing jobs we don't like. You don't choose the way we look, our height, our talent, and in many cases, our health. There are lies, deception, and senseless violence all over the place. Gravity literally keeps us earthbound. We can't jump higher than a few feet off the ground. You know, you travel east or west, and eventually you run into an ocean, you know, or it's really hard to navigate, right? You go north or south, you have frigid polar ice caps, and if you go up, you've got cold space, which you need to achieve the escape velocity, which requires so much energy and money to produce the energy, not to mention the know-how of a rocket scientist. And then there's the small little matter of the Van Allen radiation belt to travel through. And you go down and you have hard rock and caves and molten lava. So, we're pretty much bound to this earth. But I think art imitates life, and perhaps the Hermetic principle of as above, so below, and, you know, we're told that we're created in God's image. Maybe these can give us some insight into our purpose here. And that sort of implies that entertainment and humor, you know, is here. It's such a big deal, and it's probably also there. So here on Earth, entertainment is king, and sports, television, Hollywood, and the music industry are big business. We have the Olympic World Games, the big ball games, big game hunters. There's virtual reality computer games, board games, game pods, game shows. It just goes on and on. In fact, 36 near-death experiencers say they got the distinct impression that life was some form of entertainment. David Jay said, "I asked him what the meaning of life is. He told me, for the entertainment of the spirit realm," end quote. Dwayne S. said, I was also reminded that the reason we leave the celestial realm at all was for the excitement, variety, adventure, and entertainment that different incarnations offer. As one entity jokingly remarked, if the eternal divine part of us grows tired of singing and playing harps, there are thousands of other universes created for our spiritual growth, amusement, and entertainment. Eternity is a long time to do nothing but play harps, end quote. And Nancy D said, it's my understanding that what transpired during my NDE is the real reality. Life as a human is more like a dream, role in a play, virtual reality game, character in a drama, etc., though these words fall far short of actual explanation, end quote. And there's more quotes from the end of the years in the section on near-death experiences and the light on my website. Video games each year become more and more lifelike, and you do Wii or any of these games, and it almost looks like you're there. And in quantum physics, matter can be either a wave or a particle, depending upon whether there is an observer's consciousness interacting with it or not. And this reminds me of object-oriented programming, where a chunk of code is only called if and when it is needed. You know, it begs the question, is you know, if a tree falls in the forest, you know, it doesn't make a sound, all that stuff, you know. Even today, as we now have realistic games like PlayStation and Xbox, as well as virtual reality technology systems like VR systems such as Oculus Rift, PlayStation VR, HTC Vive, a new phenomenon is augmented reality, which can be seen with the overnight popularity of Pokemon Go. I'm sure you've heard of that by now. It's all part of what is now becoming augmented reality, where a false reality is superimposed over what we think is reality. And director Oliver Stone said about Pokemon Go, he said, "It's what's happening is a new level of invasion, of surveillance and data mining, and they have invested a huge amount of money into what surveillance is, data mining. They're data mining every single person in this room for information as to what you're buying, what you like, above all, your behavior. It creates its own awareness, and it gets into everywhere in the world until it manipulates our behavior. And we start to act like that, which has happened already quite a bit on the internet. But you'll see a new form of, frankly, a robot society where they will know how you want to behave, and they will make the mock-up that matches how you behave and lead you in another form of behavior," end quote. If you think about a picture on a television screen, it's not the real image, but it's a reconstruction of an image using pixels. Nick Bostrom put forward an idea called the simulation theory, in which he postulated the universe we live in is a simulation. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, he gathered scientists at the 2016 annual Isaac Asimov Memorial Debate, where the topic this year was, "Is the universe a simulation?" And Tyson put the odds at 50-50 that our entire existence is a program on someone else's hard drive. He said, quote, "I think the likelihood may be very high," he said. One of the panelists, David Chalmers, a professor of philosophy at New York University, said, quote, "The way I think about it, I mean, who knows if there's actually a simulator who's actually doing any of this. But if you do take the simulation hypothesis seriously, it's got a couple of elements of a traditional God. This person could be all-knowing about our universe and could be all-powerful. The one thing which is probably missing is wisdom and benevolence." And everybody laughs. He said, that reminds me of what, George Carlin, this reminds me of what George Carlin said. He said, quote, "Results like this do not belong on the resume of a supreme being. This is the kind of shit you'd expect from an office temp with a bad attitude." Elon Musk, who's the CEO of Tesla Motor Cars, recently said, quote, "The strongest argument for us being in a simulation probably is the following. 40 years ago, we had Pong, like two rectangles and a dot. That's what games were. Now, 40 years later, we have photorealistic 3D simulations with millions of people playing simultaneously, and it's getting better every year. Soon, we'll have virtual reality, augmented reality. If you assume any rate of improvement at all, then the games will become indistinguishable from reality. Even if that rate of advancement drops by 1,000 from what it is now, then you just say, okay, let's imagine it's 10,000 years in the future, which is nothing on the evolutionary scale. So given that we're clearly on a trajectory to have games that are indistinguishable from reality, and those games could be played on any set-top box or PC or whatever, and there would be probably billions of such computers or set-top boxes, it would seem to follow that the odds that we're in a base reality, is one in billions, he said, end quote. Now, Gnostics put forth similar ideas a couple thousand years ago, and in the Gnostic book On the Origin of the World, it was written, quote, likeness emanated, became a product resembling the primeval light, and manifested as a likeness of heaven. There was an article called Programmable Matter, Shape-Shifting Microbots Get It Together, where it talks about how programs modify matter to cause it to change shape, creating an artificial reality to interact with. And if creating a VR reality is around the corner, then the odds are we're already living in one. PBS did a six-part series called The Brain, and in it, I think it was toward the beginning of the show, they said, what is reality? What if I told you that this world around us, this richly textured world, were all just an illusion constructed in your head? Instead, photons of light or air compression waves, these are getting converted into the common currency of the brain, electrochemical signals. We all have this internally generated reality. Incredible as it may sound, this world lives inside your brain. It's constantly updated by information from our senses, but moment to moment, what we experience isn't what's really out there. Instead, it's a beautifully rendered simulation. You experience reality as it's presented by your senses, and it doesn't typically strike you that things could be very different. What we've been talking about so far is what we call the visible spectrum of light, which is a spectrum of wavelengths that runs from what we call red to violet. But it turns out that this only constitutes a tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. In fact, less than 1/10 billionth of it. So all the rest of the spectrum, including radio waves and microwaves and x-rays and gamma rays, all this stuff, is flowing through our bodies right now, and we're completely unaware of it because we don't have any specialized biological receptors to pick up on it. So what this means is that the part of reality that we can see is totally limited by our biology. And this isn't just about sight. All our senses are only picking up a small part of the information that's out there, end quote. So what we have here is, you know, Earth is a farm system where everything breaks down and dies, and where the creatures are forced to literally eat and feed off each other just to survive in this food chain. There are predator and prey relationships, and also parasitic ones where leeches feed off their hosts. As humans, we like to believe we're at the top of the food chain. PBS did a three-part series called Natural Born Hustlers on the most deceptive predators and the tricks they use to be successful. And the narrator explains at the beginning of each episode, quote, everyday animals face the single greatest challenge of their lives, find food or die. With no guarantee of where the next meal is coming from, the stakes couldn't be higher. So what can animals do to tip the balance in their favor? Would they lie, cheat, or steal from one another just to get an advantage, just to survive? Come on, of course they would. Meet the planet's greatest animal hustlers, the con artists, impersonators, and thieves, animals that will do whatever it takes to get a meal, end quote. And they go on and they show the anglerfish, which dangles a light in the darkness to lure its prey. And cuttlefish hypnotize their prey with a dazzling light show. Glowworms in Antarctica hang from the ceilings of caves and look like the nighttime sky, attracting prey who are lured by the lights. And there's hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of stories involving shadow beings, which can be read on websites like yourghoststories.com. There's over 24 accounts on the near-death experiences involving shadow beings just on NDERF.org, which is Near-Death Experiences Research Foundation. And I frequently ask people I meet if they have any personal stories of shadow beings, and I'd say somewhere between 1/3 and 1/2 do. I don't know, maybe you've seen some shadow beings yourself. But shamans are known to extract these attachments or intrusions, as they're called, and Carlos Castaneda's character Don Juan mentions them. He says, quote, we have a predator that came from the depths of the cosmos and took over the rule of our lives. Human beings are its prisoners. The predator is our lord and master. It has rendered us docile, helpless. If we want to protest, it suppresses our protest. If we want to act independently, it demands that we don't do so. I have been beating around the bush all this time, insinuating to you that something is holding us prisoner. Indeed, we are held prisoner. This was an energetic fact for the sorcerers of ancient Mexico. They took us over because we are food for them, and they squeeze us mercilessly because we are their sustenance. Just as we rear chickens in chicken coops, the predators rear us in human coops, human arrows. Therefore, their food is always available to them. End quote. Dr. Edith Fiores, a hypnotherapist who wrote the book The Unquiet Dead, a psychologist treats spirit possession. And in the book, she, you know, has a bunch of clients who have spirit attachments, and she reports on all that, and she has even some techniques to get rid of them, too. So that kind of confirms that there are these spirit attachments. George Ritchie is an author who wrote Return from Tomorrow. He was a near-death experiencer where he saw spirits infiltrating the auras of bar patrons in order to get a vicarious thrill from their living bodies. John Kay, he said, quote, "My oldest son, who is a Native American healer, had driven all the way from Denver, Colorado to Houston to see me. He was shocked at how bad I looked. When he took my hand, he was shocked at how much power I had. As he performed his healing ritual, I could see my cancer fighting him. There were these black things that looked a lot like squids with single sharp black fangs on the end of each tentacle. He was pulling them out of my tissue. Later on, he told me that they were this black, greasy substance." End quote. Dr. Stephen J. Banco is a shamanic energy healer, and on his website he claims, quote, "Some toxic energies can crystallize, becoming nearly material objects, which are impossible to metabolize through the illumination process. They are like petrified wood, which no longer burns. These crystallized energies embed themselves in the physical body. Amazon shamans believe that crystallized energies are the result of black magic or sorcery. We have found that these energies can be caused by anger, envy, or hatred directed at us by another person. Sometimes they are also energetic remnants, memories of how we died, how we were hurt, or how we were killed in a former existence." End quote. He says they are, quote, "sludge and energetic residues encrusted in the chakra." End quote. And another shaman said the black goo hardens over time and it becomes harder to get off. It's attached to our energy bodies and it's a result of trauma and material attachment. Thus, it has to be rid of like a cancer, or it would, in theory, weigh you down when you leave the body. Robert Monroe, who wrote books about the out-of-body experience, has this quote on what he calls louche. And he concluded man is an experiment of someone somewhere who requires, likes, needs, values, collects, drinks, eats, or uses as a drug, a sustenance identified as louche, which is electricity, oil, oxygen, gold, wheat, water, land, old coins, uranium. It's a rare substance in somewhere, and those who possess louche find it vital for whatever it's used for. Faced with this question of supply and demand, universal law somewhere, someone decided to produce it artificially, so to speak, rather than search for it in its natural form. He decided to build a garden and grow louche, end quote. So there's another out-of-body experiencer who, he's about pretty much the father of out-of-body experiences, if I recall correctly, anyway, and he's talking about it, you know, entities feeding off the human bodies for sustenance. There's a scientific book called The Body Electric by Robert O. Becker, and he explains how the human body produces electricity. He says, quote, "Two separate currents, one from bone and the other from nerves, produce potential of opposite energies," end quote. So in order to keep these slaves in line, which provide them with a source of energy, the elite ruling class need to keep them in fear and struggling the bulk of their life. One of the major tools which the elite or the Illuminati use is duality. They love to play two sides off each other, and whether it's the false right against the false left or pitting two different countries against each other in a war, which generates a lot of income, and of course blood ritual sacrifices. As Ozzy said, generals gather at black masses. And if you think of the term black masses, it sounds like shadow beings, right? Black masses. Anyway, I'm sure you've heard of the term shadow government. too. A U.S. senator under testimony at the Iran-Contra hearing said, quote, there exists a shadowy government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, and its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of national interest, free from all checks and balances and free from the law itself, end quote. In the interest of time, I'm only going to mention just a few things about the Illuminati, and that is to show that it's not just ancient societies who worship these gods, but world leaders today still do. And we can revisit at the end if we have time, but one of the ways to control the masses is obviously through government. So let's look at the word government. The root govern means to rule or control, and the suffix ment, M-E-N-T, means mental or of the mind. So government literally means mind control. Illuminati, it means the illuminated, but it's like an umbrella term which has come to mean the small elite cadre that's running the world. And you've got factions like the Skull and Bones, Bilderberg Group, Bohemian Grove, which has the owl. It's a giant stone owl to which a mock sacrifice is offered. But contrary to Alex Jones's assertion that it represents Moloch, Moloch was a bull. The owl probably represents Inanna, who is depicted with owls, or Minerva, both of who were goddesses of wisdom and war. And the Sumerian Inanna became the Babylonian Ishtar, the Egyptian Isis, it's a term that's thrown around a lot today, the Greek Aphrodite, the Roman goddess of love, Venus, and later was associated by the Christians as Lucifer, the light bearer. So you've got Uncle Samael versus the Baphomet goat, and you know, Uncle Sam's pointing at you, and he's got this scraggly beard and dark eyes and a star on his forehead. He says, I want you. And then you have this statue of George Washington in the U.S. Capitol, and he had to be removed because he's sitting cross-legged and bare-chested and his right arm pointing up and his left arm down, but he lives in this Baphomet pose. It's the same pose as what you see Baphomet in. And we have the mythology of numerous cultures that tells us that many believe that souls went to the moon and the sun at death, and the moon and sun were worshipped, and sacrifices were made to appease the sun god. And that's all well and good, right? But those were ignorant, superstitious peoples, right? But let's look at today's world leaders, many of whom are members of secret societies. And both Freemasons and Theosophists are said to worship Lucifer. 33rd degree Freemason Albert Pike said, I believe in his book, he says, quote, yes, Lucifer is God, and unfortunately Adonai is also God, for the eternal law is that there is no light without shade, no beauty without ugliness, no white without black, for the absolute can only exist as two gods. Albert Pike, in his book Morals and Dogmas of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, he says, quote, Lucifer the light bearer, strange and mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness. Lucifer, the son of the morning, is it he who bears the light and with its splendors intolerable, blinds feeble, sensual, or selfish souls? Doubt it not. And Manly P. Hall says, quote, Lucifer represents the individual intellect and will, which rebels against the domination of nature and attempts to maintain itself contrary to natural impulse. Lucifer, in the form of Venus, is the morning star spoken of in Revelation, which is to be given to those who overcome the world. Manly P. Hall is this big 33 degree Freemason, which most people know about. In Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky, who's pretty well known within the occult circles, she said, the culmination of the secret work is the spiritual perfect man at one end of the line. The union of the three elements is the occult solvent in the soul of the world, the cosmic soul or astral light, end quote. We'll talk about the soul of the world or the cosmic soul or the astral light later on when I get to the near-death experiences. She also says, quote, Lucifer is divine and terrestrial light, the Holy Ghost and Satan at one and the same time, visible space being truly filled with a differentiated breath invisibly. And the astral light, the manifested effects of the two who are one, guided and attracted by ourselves, end quote. Now, you look at the Olympic Games, which is put on by the leaders of the world. It uses many tools of witchcraft, including a cauldron, vestal virgins, the sun, the moon, cones of power, bells, power of the eternal flame of the Olympic torch, and which symbolizes the sun being kept alive through sacrifice, in my opinion. But the pregame ceremony is held here. The original Temple of Hera stood and features the lighting of the cauldron's eternal flame by 11 women representing Vestal virgins with rays of the sun. The flame is carried on the torch relay and kept burning throughout the games. That was from the London opening ceremony. On the media guide on page 36 of the London 2012 Olympic Games opening ceremony, it says, quote, "The first torchbearer was Prometheus, who stole fire from Mount Olympus and gave it as a gift to mankind." Now, the Oxford Dictionary of English Etymology says, quote, "As the name of a friction match to produce instantaneous light, Lucifer succeeded to Prometheus," both recorded 1831. And the new shorter Oxford English Dictionary defines Lucifer as, quote, "the morning star, the planet Venus when in the sky before sunrise, Satan, the devil," end quote. The closing ceremony had a giant phoenix, which is the symbol of resurrection or reincarnation, and it was being born again or rising from the ashes of death. In the Paralympics opening ceremony, it used a ritual from a druid order with a magic sigil invoking spirits. The closing ceremony had a one-armed statue, which was inspired by Venus de Milo. And then the upcoming preview of the 2016 Brazil Games, they included a teaser which featured the Brazilian water goddess Yamanja, who's the equivalent of the Christian Virgin Mary, who was originally Inanna, Ishtar, Isis, and Venus. Inanna was known as the Venus, the Queen of Heaven, and you have this cult of Mary, which can be seen as Columbia, which is what the original United States was referred to as a tribute to the goddess Columbia, who represented the Virgin, the Virgo, the Virgin. So Virginia and Maryland were part of that. That's where the names came from. So as Inanna, Isis, Athena, and Minerva, she's often depicted with an owl. Now, Professor Griff, who was one of the members of this hip-hop or rap band named Public Enemy, he exposed the Illuminati and talked about the Elias sacrifice. So there's another current member or current person that's saying that the Illuminati is alive and well on the planet and you know, they're up to no good. So music award shows and Super Bowl halftime shows frequently use occult rituals. The MTV Music Awards, Video Awards, you know, you had Pink, who's they simulated a third degree initiation where she's hanging upside down in black and white checkered outfit. And Lady Gaga was drenched in blood as a sacrificial victim. And Keisha was drinking blood from a human heart, for God's sake. And Madonna and CeeLo performed a Black Mass Super Bowl halftime show. So it's common for stars like Rihanna and Katy Perry and others to strike the Baphomet pose with arms upward as horns. Baphomet was a goat-headed entity, and he sits cross-legged, one arm up, one arm down, and the depiction of Satan or Pan. Aleister Crowley, who was known as the evilest man on earth, had a mass which he said, quote, "And I believe in the serpent and the lion, mystery of mysteries, his name Baphomet," end quote. The most common depiction of Baphomet today is the one from Eliphas Levi's 1861 book, and Levi himself explained Baphomet. Here are some interesting quotes from some of his books. He says, quote, "Bodies are only temporary shells whence souls have to be liberated, but those which in this life obey the body compose for themselves an interior body or fluidic shell, which after death becomes their prison. Prison house and torment, until the time arrives when they succeed in dissolving it in the warmth of the divine light, towards which, however, the burden of their grossness hinders them from ascending," end quote. Says the astral light, subordinated to a blind mechanism, is a dead light. Says the astral light is the universal seducer. It transmits light and propagates darkness. It may be called equally Lucifer and Lucifuge. He says, "To subdue the serpent, that is, to govern the circle of the astral light, we must place ourselves outside its currents, that is, we must isolate ourselves." He goes on, he says, "The astral light, or soul of the world, it became afterwards the instrument of his punishment." He says, "To have control over the great magical agent, the astral light, there are two operations necessary, to concentrate and project," end quote. I think they use the duality as the key to their trick. The dark forces, such as the demiurge and archons, who represent evil, scare the souls to go to the false light, which is said to be good. And, you know, for salvation, where the religious figures, the ascended masters, angels, aliens, and archons, they pose as their guides and gurus. It's this movement back and forth between the polarities that causes the electricity, which is, the, you know, the food for the archons, and the electricity is caused by electrons flowing from a electricity is caused by electrons flowing from a negative pole to a positive one. That's what, you know, you can look that up in any book. And so they use this one eye symbolism, which is like the evil eye or the eye of Horus. It's an all-seeing eye because we are being watched and recorded all the time. And the eye of providence is seen in futuristic cyborg movies and transhumanism. And, you know, and I found this triangle of manifestation quote. I was looking through this encyclopedia of Wicca and witchcraft, which I have, and it's written by Raven Grimassi. But and the triangle is shown, and it's used in ritual, and the book explains, quote, triangle of manifestation. And by the way, this is a symbol that rappers use a lot in concerts. They'll put up with their hands the triangle. But it says, the triangle of manifestation is a phrase indicating the principle behind magical manifestation. This basic principle is rooted in the number three. According to metaphysics, in order to manifest something, three components must come together. These components are time, space, and energy. Accordingly, if one selects a space and a time and then directs energy there, a manifestation occurs, end quote. And right above that section on the triangle manifestation, it shows somebody giving the exact same sign you see the rappers giving in concerts. You got the themes and lyrics of these songs, you know, that mention the sun and the moon and the white light, you know, such as Stairway to Heaven and the Hotel California, which I've talked about on other shows. But there's a lot of Gnostic-themed Hollywood movies such as The Matrix and The Truman Show, Dark City, The Island, Gamer, and there's certain Star Trek episodes as well. In The Matrix, you know, obviously it's a sci-fi classic where Neo is told humans are nothing more than a battery and a source of power for the machines, and that he's living in a false world, a matrix. And in The Island, before their birth on Earth, these clones are created in pods and programmed via light and hypnotic suggestion that they were special and have been chosen to go to the island, which is powered by a holographic grid, you find out in the movie. The movie Gamer, where convicts and other willing participants agree to have their bodies completely controlled by a game player with user controls. But the originator of the game plans to enslave and trap all humans in the video game. The movie Monsters, Inc., where the monsters scare human children and harness the energy of their screams and use them to power their world. There's a television show in the 1960s called The Prisoner, by Everyman Pictures, and there's a village where its inhabitants are being held prisoner and controlled from a lunar base. And from here, every move of the prisoner is monitored. Likewise, The Truman Show was a movie where Truman was a metaphor for the true man, and he's unknowingly the star of a reality TV show broadcast to the rest of the world, which he's unaware of. He's living in a false world, a hoax perpetrated from the lunar room, a world within a world. And, I mean, that's what we're living in right now. We're living in a reality TV show where, you know, for their entertainment, somewhere on another dimension, they're watching the whole show and getting amusement out of it all. And yeah, I guess that pretty much sums that up. Dark City is another Gnostic movie similar to The Truman Show, where a human was given fabricated memories of his childhood life and presented a false reality. He travels to the edge of his world to go home to Shell Beach, but you know, he hits a wall, and like Truman, he tries to break through the wall. And in Star Wars, you have a battle station for the Imperial troops, which was camouflaged as a moon, and they say, look at him, he's heading for that small moon, and they say, no, that's no moon, it's a space station, it's too big to be a space station, so we're caught in its tractor beam, and it's pulling us in, you know, it's the Death Star. And there was a Star Trek pilot, which is called The Menagerie, and then another show called The Return of the Archons, and, you know, Star Trek is I've talked about this in other shows. It's really very revealing, a lot of their episodes and movies, especially the one named Coda, where Captain Janeway discusses her near-death experience in which an alien being masquerades as her father and attempts to lure her into its matrix of light where she would be a source of nourishment for him. And this causes her to wonder if all near-death experiences aren't really just alien encounters. The movie The Host, which was by the same guy that did The Truman Show, but humans are hosts to entities that look like jellyfish. And from a summary that I found online, it says, quote, "The human race has been taken over by small parasitic aliens called souls. The souls travel to distant planets, inserting themselves individually into a host body of that planet's dominant species. They are able to access the host's memories, and occupied hosts are identifiable by silver rings that form in the host's eyes." It looks just like an eclipse of the moon. Anyway, you have the National Academy of Television and Sciences, NATAS, or it's an acronym which is Satan backwards. What are the odds? And the Oscar statue of Academy Awards from, it looks like Osir or Osiris, the Egyptian god of the underworld. And both statues are gold, holding a scepter, and Osiris was the god of the underworld. The magic wands of the druids were always made out of the wood of holly, and Hollywood represents the holly wood of the druids, which is associated with Ares or Mars, the god of war, and Nergal, the god of the underworld or hell, the devil and god of pestilence. We'll get to that later. The Columbia Pictures logo shows Columbia or the Virgo or Virgin holding up the flame, like in the Olympic Games, and like the Statue of Liberty, which probably all represents Lucifer, okay? Miller Lite, there's this high life sign which depicts a witch sitting on the moon holding up a golden beer, just like the Statue of Liberty, in one arm. And the sign says, "Reel in the high life light." And then the DreamWorks Pictures logo features a little boy sitting on a moon with a fishing lure, and it's dangling down into the waters of what's presumably the earth below, doing a little fishing. The music lyrics, Stairway to Heaven, Hotel California, feature, you know, this woman that's in the light and is trying to call to the subject of the song. And anyway, it says, "The Piper's calling you to join him. There's a lady who shines white light and wants to show how everything still turns to gold." And versus Hotel California says, "She stood in the doorway. I heard the mission bell and was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. Then she lit up a candle and she showed me the way." Going to light now has become a meme. It's a cliche. It's used in jokes. And the light sometimes is shown as a lure or a trap, as in movies like A Bug's Life and Finding Nemo. Yeah. So anyway, I guess that's enough on all that section. I'm going to go a little bit into science. And there's this PBS Nova documentary called Creatures of Light. And it was a special by National Geographic, where they studied bioluminescent and biofluorescent creatures. And when threatened, certain species shoot bright flashes of light to stun and confuse their enemies. And many fish use light to lure food in, like in Finding Nemo, the anglerfish. This French biologist was working on a firefly cousin called Pyrophorus, deciphered the chemistry responsible for their magical glow. He determined it's the result of reaction between two chemicals, which he named luciferin and luciferase, named for the fallen angel Lucifer, the light bearer. And over the last century, this light-producing reaction has been discovered scattered across the entire natural world, both above the surface and beneath the waves. That's how readily available these ingredients are. The actual chemicals differ from creature to creature, but the basic mechanism of fuel and spark is the same, from flies and worms to jellies and fish to snails, even mushrooms. The reaction is so common it's evolved independently on different branches of the evolutionary tree more than 40 separate times. You find it from single-celled bacteria up through things like starfish, jellyfish, up through the vertebrates, fishes. It's evolved so many times in so many different lineages. I mean, if it wasn't important to the organisms, you wouldn't see it all over the tree of life. Fluorescent chemicals absorb light in a unique way. Down at the atomic level, light jolts electrons into more energetic orbits around the nucleus. When they fall back to their original state, a few billionths of a second later, the electrons re-emit or fluoresce the light back at a lower energy level, giving off a different color. Biofluorescence is an odd property because the animals don't actually produce any light. But once light hits water, things get interesting. Water acts like a filter, and the different wavelengths are only able to penetrate to certain depths. Here's some science articles on magnetic portals. So I speculate that the tunnel that souls travel through during their near-death experiences leads to the light of what could be the astral sun. So how would that be possible? Well, check this out. I found an article at NASA's website entitled Hidden Portals in Earth's Magnetic Field. And quote, it says, we call them X points or electron diffusion regions. They're places where the magnetic field of Earth connects to the magnetic field of the sun, creating an uninterrupted path leading from our own planet to the sun's atmosphere, 93 million miles away, end quote. Space.com says, quote, like giant cosmic chutes between the Earth and Sun, magnetic portals open up every 8 minutes or so to connect our planet with its host star, end quote. And in a new Scientist magazine, an article quoting a Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist says, quote, a mane of dark matter may stream out from the Earth and calls these features hairs. The focus or root of one such hair would be about 1 million kilometers above Earth, quote, just beyond the moon, end quote. So a concept that fits in perfectly with the pattern behavior of archons is the concept of ideas spreading culturally by what's called a meme. And memes are Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Selfish Gene, gave a brief definition and examples. And Richard Brody wrote about the meme extensively in his book, Virus of the Mind. The biological definition of the meme from Dawkins is the meme is the basic unit of cultural transmission or imitation. According to this definition, everything we call culture is composed of atom-like memes, which compete with one another. These memes spread by being passed from mind to mind in the same way genes spread by being passed down through the sperm and egg. The most interesting memes to a biologist have to do with behavior. Dawkins' original examples of memes were tunes, ideas, catchphrases, clothes fashions, way of making pots or of building arches. Interesting arches and archons. End quote. Quote actually ended before my little comment, but you get the point. Peter Russell in The Global Brain has some interesting things, which I'm not going to get into, but there was this group called the Spiritual Science Research Foundation, and it was a group of spiritually minded scientists who meditate and use tools like EEG and muscle memory, and their conclusions of what happens at death supports my findings. And on their website, they conclude, quote, the divine light in actuality is definitely seen by people who have a genuine desire for God realization. Those above a spiritual level of 50% or 60% are actually able to see divine light either due to immense merits or very little ego. As they are above the 50% or 60% spiritual level, they don't just see the light, but also finally reach the divine heavenly light. And they're talking about this is what happens at death, by the way. And they said, quote, those people without a genuine desire for God realization who see a light are in fact seeing the light generated by an illusion-creating subtle sorcerer called a mantric. And subtle sorcerers, due to their high spiritual strength, can create illusions of light as well as feelings of peace and happiness radiating from the light. These illusions are created by their spiritual powers and their black energy. They use this as a mechanism to lure subtle bodies into the light and trap them into slavery. End quote. And the foundation estimates that only less than 4% of the world's current population is at a spiritual level of 50% or greater, and they claim a level of 60% is needed to be liberated from the cycle of birth and death. And this means that if the other 96% see a light, it is from the sorcerer in order to trap and enslave them. I want to get a little bit into religion, since it plays a big part in all this. But basically, you go back to the beginning, and Sumer is the first civilization, and therefore the closest to the original source. And the Sumerians recorded history ranging from such mundane topics as business transactions, education, politics, law, etc., and accurately. And as a matter of fact, so why question why they said we were created for? I mean, if they're just routinely recording all these business transactions and stuff, and they also happen to talk matter-of-factly about why we were created. I mean, why? I mean, I guess you can question it, obviously, but I guess it does lend some credibility to what they're saying. But they said we were created for, you know, basically slave labor and to toil and worship the gods. The original players of the game were, according to them, Nama, who was the Mother Earth goddess. An was the Sky Father, the Most High of the Earth gods. Enlil, who's the favorite son of An, he's the god of lightning and storm, and the name means Lord of Air, and he decides to destroy mankind with a deluge. Enki, who is the oldest son and half-brother of Enlil, his name means god of earth. Enki was known as the god of fresh waters with wisdom, magic, science, and the creator as his main task. Told humans to save themselves from the coming flood, although he was prohibited from doing so. And he has the oldest continual temple in the world in Eridu, which was for 4,500 years. Ninursag was the daughter similar to her mother Nama and midwife to the gods. And all gods are said to be raised on the milk of Ninursag. Her symbol is the Omega symbol. Nana is the god of the moon, the son of Enlil. Utu is the god of the sun. And Inanna was the young goddess, the god of Venus, goddess of Venus, the beauty and war, and later became Ishtar, Isis, and many other names. So Namu, or Nama, was worldwide. She's the mother goddess, became known as Tiamat, and she was almost forgotten, but her identity was stolen, and she became, they turned her into Inanna, Ishtar, and Isis. Let's look at what some of these ancient original texts closest to the source say. So you have this creation quote from Enki to Namu. The texts say we were created to eliminate the toil of the gods and also to worship them. So Nama told Enki, quote, please apply the skill deriving from your wisdom and create a substitute for the gods so that they can be freed from their toil, end quote. And after Enki, the fashioner of designs by himself, had pondered the matter, he said to his mother Nama, quote, my mother, the creature you plan will really come into existence. Impose on him the work of carrying baskets. You should knead clay from the top of the Apsu. The birth goddesses will nip off the clay, and you shall bring them forth into existence. Bring the form into existence, end quote. In the Babylonian creation myth, the Enuma Elish says, quote, may he shepherd the black-headed ones, his creatures, to the end of days without forgetting, let them acclaim his ways. May he establish for his fathers the great food offerings. Their support they shall furnish, shall tend their sanctuaries. May he cause incense to be smelled, their spells. May a likeness on earth of what he has wrought in heaven, may he order the black-headed to revere him. May the subjects ever bear in mind to speak of their god, and may they at his word pay heed to the goddess. May food offerings be borne for their gods and goddesses. Without fail, let them support their gods. Their lands, let them improve. Build their shrines. Let the black-headed wait on their gods, end quote. Now, it's important to know when they mention black-headed ones, they are actually referring to black-haired people, and it's not a racial skin color. Please keep in mind that all souls are made of the same liquid light. The physical body is just a suit we wear or a token we choose to play in this game of Monopoly. Some choose to be the thimble and others choose to be the top hat, but in the astral realm, all souls are equal. So there's this quote, we're created as slaves to worship the gods, and the peacemaking god, Ea, who's the king of wisdom, admonishes the first Tesseb's party, and then Kumarbi, reminding them of all the destruction of human worshippers, means disaster for all the gods, since mortals serve and support them. Now, Ea, king of wisdom, spoke among the god. The god Ea began to say, quote, "Why are you, plural, destroying mankind? They will not give sacrifices to the gods. They will not burn cedar as incense to you. If you destroy mankind, they will no longer worship the gods. No one will offer bread or libations to you any longer. Even Teseb, Cumulus' heroic king, will himself grasp the plow. Even Saska and Hebab will themselves grind at the millstones," end quote. Now, Nergal was the Mesopotamian god of the underworld. He was a son of Enlil. I know online sometimes they say he's a son of Enki, and there are a couple quotes that could maybe mislead one to believe that, but there are many, many more that are very clear that he's the son of Enlil. And Nergal was the god of war and plague. He was not very high in status early on, and at some point, An helped him by giving him seven companions or weapons, otherwise known as the seven evil spirits. Nergal then planned to take over the underworld, which already had a goddess in charge. Her name was Ereshkigal. Nergal forced his way into the underworld and took the goddess by her hair and dragged her off the throne to cut her head off. And in her tears, she offered to be his wife and give him the underworld, and he took the deal and let her live. Nergal now controlled the underworld and the judgment of every human who dies. So there's just a ton of quotes about Nergal that illustrates his evil. And here's Sumerian literature. It says, "Lord of the underworld, who acts swiftly in everything, whose terrifying anger smites the wicked, Nergal, the single-handed crusher who tortures the disobedient," end quote. From the text of the tablets found at Telamana, Nergal was well known and referenced in a letter from the king of Crete to his brother, the king of Egypt. The Nergal myth is the only myth found on the Telamana tablets, and they were found in Egypt, not Mesopotamia, and date to about 1300 BC. It says, quote, "Nergal, the lion-headed god, seems here to be the same as Namtar, death, or fate. His name in Akkadian may mean King Death. The infernal deity was usually represented with a lion or tiger head and open jaws," end quote. J.C. Greenfield, in a book, said, quote, "An epithet of the god Nergal in Hatra inscriptions is related to his role of punishing divinity. In the meaning of, quote, executioner, butcher, torturer, he was primarily keeper of the underworld and the god of pestilence. As the god of the underworld, he functioned as a judge. His lion-headed mace was able to punish and wreak vengeance," end quote. The reason I'm giving all these Nergal quotes is because there's good reason to show that he is basically Yahweh of the Old Testament. Now, we'll get into it later, but Yahweh was a composite of many of the gods, but he seemed to have a lot of the same personalities as Nergal. Now, J.C. Grin, the book The Esoteric Codex, Deities in the Underworld by William Kloss, says, quote, "Being a deity of the desert, god of fire, Nergal was sometimes called a demon and even identified with Satan," end quote. The book Babylonian Magic by Michael W. Ford says, quote, "Nergal, who is mighty and with a fiery surrounding in which you are encircled, who raises the lion mace. Nergal, who takes the form of the lion dragon, raise thy blade. To that terrifying splendor, no other god stands before. Hail to thee, Nergal, Nergal, dragon supreme, great god. I call you by the fires of Sharapu, thou burning fires of conquest. By the funeral rites to which you were called to, the shades which drink blood in your name. May the seven tear their souls to ribbons. In this flame I curse them. Let the serpent's tongue arise. Nergal's fiery serpents shall encircle it and consume their essence," end quote. That's just beautiful, huh? He also writes, Kutha, quote, "Kutha has an association with the underworld due to the temple of Nergal," end quote. The seven that he refers to is the evil seven, the seven demon spirits that were created by An or Anu. They are the workers of Nergal, so they're always used by him to kill. And in the Era epic, Era is another name for Nergal, after spelled E-R-R-A. After Anu had ordained destinies for all the seven, he gave those very ones to Era, warrior of the gods, saying, "Let them go beside you. When the clamor of human habitations becomes noisome to you, and you resolve to wreak destruction, to massacre the black-headed folk and fell the livestock, let these be your fierce weaponry. Let them go beside you," end quote. Nergal, also known as Era, later became known as Ares, and he had his temple and worshippers moved to Samaria, the kingdom of Israel. The book The Seven Great Monarchies of the Ancient Eastern World chronicles Nergal's move to Israel. It says, quote, the city peculiarly dedicated to Nergal was Kutha or Tagaba, which is constantly called his city in the inscriptions. He was worshipped also at Tarbisa near Nineveh, but in Tagaba he was said to live, and his shrine was there, won a great celebrity, hence the men of Kuth, when transported to Samaria by the Assyrians, naturally enough made Nergal their god, carrying his worship with them into their new country. End quote. There was a priestly class of shepherd kings, which took religion worldwide, and the names changed from culture to culture, but the attributes of the gods stay the same. You can practically trace this nomadic group of barbarians and shepherd kings through etymology. We get these names, Kuth, Gudi, Gudea, Scythe, Scot, Goth, Celt, Kurd, etc. So the Kuthans are originally from Babylonia at the temple for Nergal and were moved to Samaria, the capital of the Kingdom of Israel. The Kingdom of Israel was originally called Samaria. This is the Assyrian historical account of Samaria and what happened about 713 BC to the Kingdom of Israel. And I want to make a distinction between Samaria and Sumeria. They're different, okay? But it says, quote, the inhabitants of Samaria, who agreed and plotted with a king hostile to me, not to do service and not to bring tribute to Ashur, and who did battle, I fought against thou with the power of great gods, my lords. I counted as spoil 27,280 people, together with their chariots and gods in which they trusted. I formed a unit with 200 of their chariots from my royal force. I settled the rest of them in the midst of Assyria. I repopulated Samaria more than before. I brought into it people from countries conquered by my hands. I appointed my eunuch as governor over them, and I counted them as Assyrians. Okay, so let's, end quote. So, okay, let's rewind. That's the king of Assyria defeated the king of Israel, took 27,000 of the residents and dispersed them through Assyria. He then took the Babylonians, who the king had conquered, and settled them in Israel. This means the original population of Samaria, or Israel, was evicted and replaced with Babylonians. These Babylonians included the major city of Nergal, which was Kutha. So even the high priests of Nergal moved to Israel and began worshiping there. A majority of the dispersed original population never returned. Now in the New Testament, Jesus enters into the temple teaching and talking to the Pharisees. After quite a heated discussion, Jesus states that his father is not the same as their father. I speak which I have seen, here's this quote, I speak that which I have seen with my father, and ye do that which ye have seen with your father, end quote. In John 8:44, he says, quote, ye are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. A little over half the world belongs to religion, end quote. A little over half of the world belongs to a religion that worships Yahweh as God. Jews, Christians, Muslims, all these holy wars have been fought in his name, and millions have been killed in his name. So let's take a look at who this Yahweh character really is. Who is Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament? You do a search on Google for, quote, God of Pestilence, end quote. If you search for the God of Pestilence, the very first result is Nergal. There really was no other God of Pestilence. Search the King James Version of the Bible for Pestilence. If you search the Old Testament for Pestilence, you get 45 hits. 45 hits that will prove to anyone that the God of Israel was Nergal at many times. Now, Yahweh is a composite of many pagan gods, including El, Baal, Bel, and others, but his personality most closely resembles Nergal. So the Lord sent a pestilence. This is a quote from the Bible. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning even to the time appointed, and there died of the people from Dan, even to Beersheba, 70,000 men. 3 days the sword of the Lord, even the pestilence in the land, and the angel of the Lord destroying throughout all the coast of Israel. It's another quote. Sacrifice unto the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. For now I will stretch out my hand that I may smite thee and thy people with pestilence. And I will bring a sword upon you that shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant. And when you are gathered together within your cities, I will send the pestilence among you, and ye shall be delivered into the hand of the enemy. I will smite them with the pestilence, and disinherit them, and will make of thee a greater nation, and mightier than they. The Lord shall make the pestilence cleave unto thee, until he have consumed thee from off the land, whither thou goest to possess it. If I shut up heaven that there be no rain, or if I command the locusts to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among my people, he made a way to his anger. He spared not their soul from death, but gave their life over to the pestilence. When they fast, I will not hear their cry, and when they offer burnt offering and an oblation, I will not accept them, but I will consume them by the sword and by the famine and by the pestilence. There's just a gazillion of those quotes. Well, actually, there's 45. In the Gnostic texts, I guess we should talk about the Gnostics. They're contemporaries of the second century Christians, and the Orthodox Church declared them heretics, killed them, and destroyed their books. Now, later in another wave, 20,000 Cathar Gnostics were declared heretics, and the Pope ordered them murdered. If you think the Vatican's a powerful, impossible, evil entity, and part of the powers that be, the Illuminati or whatever, then that makes what the Gnostics taught very interesting. And if the Catholic Church viewed the Gnostic texts as heresy or more likely just wanted to protect their own lies, then that makes what the Gnostics had to say quite likely the truth, or at least something that deserves serious consideration. The Gnostics said this world and physical plane is a prison ruled by a false god named Yaldabaoth or Demiurge and his archon rulers. These archons are like shadow beings that were created from bile and the jealousy of the Demiurge when he was informed he was not truly God. They said that Demiurge was a deluded and blind god. So these archons can shapeshift and appear as either shadow beings or demons or a more physical appearance, perhaps, as aliens, greys, reptilians, and insectoids. I tend to think all these aliens that are perceived as being physical are more an astral reality, so they seem to be physical, but it's really part of the astral. So they feed off, these archons feed off of life force, negative energy mostly, but also ecstatic energy like at arenas or churches. They're mind parasites. They can create hallucinations and illusions, and there's a counterfeit spirit, and there's voices, and Christians call them demons, Muslims call them jinn, and some call them spirit guides or guardian angels. You know, all these archangels and guardian angels and whatnot, I just don't think there's anything positive about them whatsoever. The Gnostic texts describe the shadow beings. They said, quote, "Now the eternal realm of truth has no shadow outside it, for the limitless light is everywhere within it. But its exterior is shadow, which has been called by the name darkness. From it there appeared a force presiding over the darkness. And the forces that came into being subsequent to them called the shadow the limitless chaos. From it every kind of divinity sprouted up, together with the entire place, so that also shadow is posterior to the first product. It was the abyss that it appeared, deriving from the aforementioned pistis. Now matter is made of the bile of the shadow. Now as for that jealousy, it was formed to be an abortion without any spirit in it. Like a shadow, it came into existence, into a vast watery substance. Then the bile that had come into being out of the shadow was thrown into a part of chaos. Since that day, a watery substance has been apparent. And what sank within it flowed away, being visible in chaos, as with a woman giving birth to a child." That sounds like Revelations right there. "And all her superfluities flow out. Just so matter came into being out of shadow and was projected apart, and it did not depart from chaos. Rather, matter was in chaos, being in a part of it," end quote. Carlos Castaneda, which we mentioned earlier, said about the parasites, he said, quote, "I did see some strange fleeting black shadow projected on the foliage of the trees. It was either a shadow going back and forth or various fleeting shadows moving side to side or straight up in the air. They looked like fat black fish to me, enormous fish. It was as if gigantic swordfish were flying in the air. I was engrossed in the sight. Then finally it scared me. It became too dark to see the foliage, yet I could still see the fleeting black shadows," end quote. The shaman told Carlos, "The best way to rid yourself of it is with inner silence and thought discipline. The second you feel agitation, anxiety, or anything like that, don't allow it to manifest in reality. You may feel agitated, but you don't allow it to manifest into actions onto others or yourself." Some of these shadow creatures take the form of astral or etheric spiders, and there's also this creature known as the Hat Man. But Sophia, who's the mother goddess, created Demiurge in air without her partner, without her consort. He was created without spirit, which kind of lends you to believe he's artificial intelligence of some sort. Now, the Demiurge stole her light, the light of Sophia, in order to get his creation, mankind, to stand. So let's look at some of the heretical views of the Gnostics. And on the origin of the world, Nagamati text, this is, quote, "After the natural structure of the immortal beings had completely developed out of the infinite, a likeness then emanated from Pistis. It's called Sophia. It exercised volition and became a product resembling the primeval light, a copy of the real light. And immediately her will manifested itself as a likeness of heaven, having an unimaginable magnitude. It was between the immortal beings and those things that came into being after them, like she functioned as a veil dividing mankind from the things above," end quote. So here's another quote. "The Demiurge's heavens are a copy," I'm just going to explain. "The Demiurge's heavens are a copy of the real heavens." Here's a quote. "And she established each of his offspring in conformity with its power, after the pattern of the realms that are above. For by starting from the invisible world, the visible world was invented," end quote. And in the Gnostic text, Pistis Sophia, which means faith and wisdom, it is written, quote, "She," Sophia, "had been deluded through the godlike, self-willed," which is the Demiurge, "and had not been deluded through anything else save through a light power because of its resemblance to the light in which she had had faith," end quote. Most likely the being of intense white light that near-death experiencers go to is related to the Demiurge, in my opinion. Here's a quote from the Secret Book of John, a Gnostic text from the Nagamati Library. Quote, "Yadabaoth, Demiurge, said to the authorities," archons that were with him, "Come, let us create a human being after the image of God and with a likeness to ourselves, so that this human image may give us light," end quote. So we have this concept of the human body as a container of light. And here's another quote from the Gnostic text where it says, "He answered and said, yes, but if you wish that he not be able to ruin our work, come, let's create a human being from the earth according to the image of our body and according to the likeness of this being to serve us, so that whenever this being sees his likeness, he may become enamored of it. Then he will no longer ruin our work, but we shall make those who are born from the light our servants through all the time of this age. Now all this came to pass according to the forethought of Pistis, in order that humankind might appear after this likeness and condemn them on account of their fashioned bodies. And their fashioned bodies became fences for the light," end quote. Another quote. "After the day of rest, Sophia sent her daughter Zoe, being called Eve, as an instructor, in order that she might make Adam, who had no soul, arise, so that those whom he should engender might become containers of light," end quote. In the Secret Book of John, it says, quote, "Because she had an unconquerable power, her thought was not unproductive. Something imperfect came out of her, different in appearance from her. Because she had created it without her masculine counterpart, she gave rise to a misshapen being unlike herself. Sophia saw what her desire produced. It changed into the form of a dragon with a lion's head and eyes flashing lightning bolts. She cast him far from her, outside of the realm of the immortal beings, so that they could not see him. Sophia surrounded him with a brilliant cloud, put a throne in the center part of the cloud so that no one would see it. She named him Yadabaoth. Yadabaoth is the chief ruler. He took great power from his mother, left her, and moved away from his birthplace. He assumed command, created realms for himself with a brilliant flame that continues to exist even now," end quote. Sophia, she repents and is forgiven by the Source, and Source sends help to take back the light power from the Demiurge. It's probably us. In the meantime, the Demiurge created the human body but cannot get it to stand. The help from Source convinces the Demiurge that he must breathe life into Adam to get him to move. And when he does, the light power goes into Adam. This Adam was divine because of the light power, and this light power sort of has similar overtones to the Holy Spirit. in every human. The archons supposedly were produced not in full and are unable to hold the light power. And what she had created became a product in the matter, like an aborted fetus. And it assumed a plastic form molded out of shadow, became an arrogant beast resembling a lion. It changed into a form of a lion-faced serpent, and his eyes were like lightning fires which flash. And when she saw the product of her will, it was different. A model of a lion-faced serpent, his eyes were like flashing fires of lightning, and it changed into a form of a dragon with a lion's head. Self-willed uniteth himself with the rulers of the 12 ions, and emanates a lion-faced power to plague Sophia. End quote. Getting back to the Sumerian text, there's a Sumerian text about Enlil, the god of the air, and his goat wrestlers, which reads, quote, Enlil, the roaring storm that subjugates the entire land, the rising deluge that cannot be confronted, was considering what should be destroyed in return for the wrecking of his beloved Iker. He lifted his gaze toward the Guban Mountains and made all the inhabitants of the broad mountain ranges descend. Enlil brought out of the mountains those who do not resemble other people, who are not reckoned as part of the land, the Gushans, an unbridled people with human intelligence but canine instincts. And monkeys' features. Like small birds, they swooped on the ground in great flocks. Because of Enlil, they stretched their arms out across the plain like a net for animals. Nothing escaped their clutches. No one left their grasp. Messengers no longer traveled the highways. The courier's boat no longer passed along the rivers. The Gushans drove the trusty goats of Enlil out of their folds and compelled their herdsmen to follow them. They drove the cows out of their pens and compelled their cowards to follow them. Prisoners man the watch, end quote. Now, Gushans took over Kutha, and they set up a temple for Nergal, and then the Gushans, or the Kutham, or the Khazars, were the nomadic, barbaric, royal shepherd kings of the Anunnaki, and they spread their religions all over the world, and while conquering everywhere they went, which extended to Egypt, Europe, India, China, Arabia, and other places. But these royal shepherd kings were driven out, and they built a city in Judea called Jerusalem. And both Israel and Jerusalem got their names from the angel of death and the demiurge. And Israel got its name from an angel named Israel, which he fought with. But we'll cover all that in a little bit. Genesis 32:29 states, quote, Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome, end quote. It's primarily found in magical and mystical literature, and in these texts, Jacob's identity as the angel Israel sometimes converges with that of the nation of Israel. And in the book Angels A to Z, Israel's an angel. It says, quote, Israel, which means striver with God, is generally considered an angel of the order of Haoth, a class of angels who surround God's throne. In the Alexandrian Gnostic prayer of Joseph, the patriarch Jacob is an archangel named Israel, who entered earthly life from a pre-existent state. He also identifies himself as the angel Uriel, end quote. Hebrews claim the name Israel means God prevails or God fights. This makes sense when you realize the God Yahweh was the composite of many gods, including the god of war and pestilence, Ares, otherwise known as Mars or Nergal. The Gnostic book, On the Origin of the World, the Demiurge, who's a false god and also called Ariel, quote, And from that voice he called himself the Audabaoth, but the perfect ones call him Ariel because he was like a lion, end quote. The book Dictionary of the Angels, including the Falling Angels, by Gustav Davidson mentions, quote, Ariel, meaning a lion of God, is the name of an angel of the apocryphal Ezra, also in Mothers, A Greater Key of Solomon, The Grand Grimoire, and other tracts of magic, where he is pictured as a lion-headed, Cornelius Agrippa says, quote, Ariel is the name of an angel, sometimes also and of a demon, and of a city, whence called Areopolis, where the idols worshipped. Jewish mystics use Ariel as a poetic name for Jerusalem. In Gnostic lore, he generally is a ruler of winds and equated with Yaldabaoth as an older name for this god, end quote. The archangel Azrael, or Ezreal, is the equivalent in Muslim lore to the angel of death or the grim reaper who comes to take the soul at death. Ariel, meaning the lion of God in Hebrew, is also known as Uriel. Of Uriel, Wikipedia states, quote, In Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's translation of the Golden Legend, Uriel is one of the angels of the seven planets. Uriel is the angel of Mars, end quote. In the Book of Enoch, it is said Uriel was the leader of the fallen angels. Quote, then Uriel answered me, one of the holy angels who was with me, and said unto me, Enoch, why hast thou such fear and fright? And I answered, because of this fearful place, and because of the spectacle of the pain. And he said unto me, this place is the prison of the angels, and here they will be imprisoned forever. And all these Uriel, the holy angel who is the leader of them all, showed to me. End quote. Wikipedia also says, Ariel literally means lion of God. Ari, lion in Hebrew, is also a synonym for bravery and courage, is also the symbol of the tribe of Judah. The city of Ariel is named after Jerusalem. Ariel in the Hebrew Bible is one of the names for Jerusalem and the temple of Jerusalem. And quote, in Isaiah 29:1, it says, woe to David's city, woe to you, Ariel. Ariel, the city where David settled, add year after year, and your cycle of festivals goes on. Isaiah 29:2 says, yet I will besiege Ariel. She will mourn and lament. She will be to me like an altar hearth, end quote. Wikipedia also equates Azrael with the angel of death, even in Hebrew. Quote, Azrael is often identified with the archangel of death in Hebrew, Sikhism lore, as well as Islam, end quote. The Yazidi people, who have been accused of worshiping Satan, also mention Israel in their holy black book. Quote, then on the first day, Sunday, it created an angel called Israel, that's with a Z. He is archangel over all the angels, he who is Melektos, the peacock angel, end quote. The land of Israel was named for Ares, the god of war. In Wikipedia, says the term Eretz Israel, or the land of Israel, was part of the official Hebrew name of Mandatory Palestine, end quote. That Ares Israel was spelled E-R-E-T-Z, but it's pronounced Ares. That's actual Hebrew. The medieval Jewish civilization encyclopedia reveals, quote, the homeland of the Jews, for whom it was always as it is today, Ares Israel, the land of Israel, or simply Ha Ares, the land of war. I mean, they're literally spelling it A-R-E-S, just like the god Mars, Ares. The land of Canaan, the promised land, the holy land. You know, that's the Ares. That's the land is very important in Jewish and Hebrew tradition, because you have the land of Canaan, the promised land, the holy land. And Ares means land. It's pronounced the same as Ares, the Greek equivalent of Nergal, the Mesopotamian god of the underworld and god of war, basically the devil. Samaria was the capital city of the Kingdom of Israel and is a combination of two names equated with the Demiurge or the Gnostic devil, Samael and Ariel. The Gnostic text Pistis Sophia reads, quote, and from that voice he called himself Yadabaoth, but the perfect ones call him Ariel because he was like a lion, and after he came to possess authority over matter, end quote. Let's move on to early Christianity and the founding of the church and Roman Catholicism. So Nergal, who's also known as Ares or Mars, was a central figure of Roman Catholicism and therefore Christianity. The Ancient History Encyclopedia writes, quote, in Roman mythology, Mars was also the father of Romulus and Remus through the rape of the Vestal Virgin Rhea Silvia. The legendary fathers of Rome, and therefore the city, achieved a sacred status. Like Athena for Athens, Mars was also patron god of the Roman capital. It says, quote, Mars was loved by Venus, the goddess of beauty, but wishing to keep their love a secret from the other gods, they met only during the night. End quote. Mars and Venus had six children together during their adulterous affairs, and both were married. They were figurines found recently which show that Asherah was Yahweh's consort. There's been much speculation lately that Yahweh was married to Asherah because of these discoveries. The National Geographic documentary The Cult of Mary also studied apparitions of the Virgin Mary around the world. And some of these Marian apparitions are very graphic in the content of the messages given, including apocalyptic descriptions. One receiver of the messages even referred to Mary as, quote, the August Queen of Heaven. such a sure allusion to Inanna, who is known as the Queen of Heaven. The use of the word August, August is a dead giveaway. Muhammad also came from Kutha. The Encyclopedia Britannica, Volume 17, page 399, reads, quote, "The sanctuary was apparently in the possession of the tribe Quraysh, the origin whose name is unknown, said to have come originally from Kutha in Mesopotamia. They are known as the people of Allah, and by wearing a badge were sacrosanct throughout Arabia. There seems to be no doubt that Muhammad himself was a member of the tribe Quraysh," end quote. It is said the word Quran means the recitation. The Quran says it was recited to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. So basically, the religion of Islam was given to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, Gabriel is the angel of fire and says, quote, "In heaven, Gabriel is set over the serpents," end quote. Now, Jebel in Sumerian mythology is a god of fire, of the son of An and Ki. That makes Gabriel, the son of the chief archon or demiurge, the top god of the Anunna. There's, because, originally An was the king of the Sumerians, the top god, and so that made him a demiurge. But I think later in history, it was passed down to his son Enlil, and then in turn to the grandson, who was Nergal. Anyway, there's evidence to suggest that the Quran is related to the Quraysh tribe that Muhammad came from and is derived from Q-R-E, or Kor, who is the goddess of the underworld, Persephone. This is likely where the Quran got its name from. Kre was represented by the waxing crescent moon. She's also represented as the morning and evening star, which is Venus. Then you have the altar of Mars, which was in Rome. And the call to Mary, which I mentioned, is the wife of the god Nergal, or Yahweh. Her name was Asherah. Christianity has the dirty little handprints of kings all over it, and named the official religion by the Emperor Constantine, and later the King James Version, which had books named Kings 1 and Kings 2. You have kings such as King David, King Solomon, and Moses was raised in the court of Pharaoh. Anyway, I'm going to get into this last section, which is on the light and near-death experiences, and it's probably the most important one because it involves personal testimony of those who were declared dead and got a small glimpse into what actually may happen when we die. There are enough similarities in the afterlife reports to give the phenomenon credibility, in my opinion. So there's this website which was created by Jeff Long called NDERF.org, the Near-Death Experiences Research Foundation, and has over 4,000 near-death experience reports on it. Three-fourths of them have out-of-body experiences. Two-thirds of them of near-death experiences encounter a mythical or brilliant light, and one-third of them pass through a tunnel. I've mentioned the quotes from some of the near-death experiencers on that, the fact that life is a game or entertainment. But many of them sometimes enter darkness or avoid it first, which is oftentimes very peaceful, where they could stay forever. And researcher Stanislav Grof mentioned the void in a very positive manner, and that it could be, where ideas are birthed, and where it's like a pregnant space where things are created. But so I did a search for void on NDERF, and I don't remember the exact results, but like maybe two-thirds of them were kind of positive and the other third were negative. I mean, for me, it's not enough to like roll my dice on, hey, I'm just going to go to the void and stay there. It just doesn't seem the way to go, in my opinion. But anyway, the near-death experiencers say the soul is made of light, a liquid light or a fluorescent light, and it's like a luminous egg. It looks like maybe a see-through amoeba with gears, according to my friend who I interviewed. Anthony N. said, quote, "I was just pure consciousness with no body in the other place. I had physical form, but my body, like everything else there, was made of liquid light." They travel at high speeds, end quote. They travel at high speeds by thought, intent, or desire, and they can manifest reality by thought. A it's like a plasma-like environment which allows for high conductivity. It's kind of my way of thinking about it. Brian Z said, I felt that I could move at the speed of light. This was in no way a physical sense of movement, not three-dimensional. It was as if I was propelled by thought rather than body. What existed was pure will, end quote. So, you know, here's near-death experiences. Quite a few of them said that they can manifest reality while there, or they can travel just by thought or intent. And that mirrors a lot of what William Buhlmann says, and, you know, as a basis of his 16,000-plus out-of-body experiment reports. Brian, anyway, so they're going to the light. Most of them are pulled to the light through desire or curiosity, I think. And it's not against the will, but they're just curious about what that light is, and they have this inner desire to go there, and that's what happens. The most be described being drawn to the tunnel, moving toward the tunnel, finding themselves going towards, or sometimes being pulled into the tunnel like a magnet. And this tunnel or vortex or pipe is two or more tunnels. One arches up toward the light, one down to darker or less positive experience. And in the tunnel, they mention vibration and color and music, wind, magnetism, and electricity. Matt S. said, quote, I saw a tube projecting up at about a 45-degree angle, much like a pipe in the ground. Above it, approximately two mouth diameters away, were two very bright white lights. These lights pivoted towards a target soul ascending the tunnel and paused for a few seconds while the soul entered the light. The light would then pivot like a searchlight towards another soul and pause again while the soul entered the light. Both lights were identical and moved similar but independently. I knew that those were souls entering the light, end quote. So they describe the light as being like 1,000 times brighter than the sun, but it doesn't hurt the eyes, and it's like a translucent light. Joe D. said, I was being taken to a sun behind our sun where dwells the light of Alpha and Omega. It was extremely painful climbing this white ladder. But when I finally reached the brilliant white light of that sun, and she goes on and on. So here she's likening the light to the sun. And on the other side, they mention a park or a garden, and that kind of dovetails with what Robert Monroe mentions in his work with the Monroe Institute on out-of-body experiences. There's this crystal city on the other side with one or more, you know, sometimes they mention a tower and a dome there, which is very peculiar to me. it's almost as if souls could be being pulled there a la like a transducer or some kind of radio transmitter or receiver might do. Anyway, Julian D. said, I recall nothing of my passage through the veil, but I have vivid memories of where I went. It was a place, a domain that I knew right away was a transfer station, a place where beings go when moving between realms. It was like a city of crystal structures and verdant green trees and vegetation. I went into a huge beyond comprehension, perhaps dome-like structure where one would go to meet with enormous beings of light, energy, and color to do the light life review. I cannot describe the feelings of awe and wonder that I was immersed in. At what time during the experience were they asked her the question on the forum, at what time during the experience were you at your highest level of consciousness and alertness? And I guess it was a guy, Julian, he said, when I was in the city, in the crystal city, the transfer station, end quote. Bonnie M. said, I was shown many wondrous things of crystal light beings, full of prisms of light as we went to another pyramid tower, and there I was shown things I am not to speak of. I can only say that the time is assured, and is happening now, indeed has happened many times before, end quote. Another one said, quote, high above the radiant sanctuary rose a translucent tower made of a solid, transparent substance similar to crystal. Harmonious melodies pointed forth from within it. The majestic shrine was a colossal hive of work and prayer. I think that one might have been one I found online and not from Nindorf. There's a river of life which some ride, and it acts as a barrier. There's a waiting hall where they're greeted by relatives, and there's a life review. About the moon, Ron A. said, quote, I believe this was God, our creator of the universe, highest power. As I took a look around, I saw a bright light. It was the moon. The sun was reflecting light off the moon's surface. We were in space, equal distance to the moon on the right side, looking from Earth. I do not think this was heaven's final destination. I think it was a greeting area to receive us when we cross over, end quote. And on the sun, you know, I wonder if the intensely bright light that the near-death experiencers are drawn to could actually be the sun, and on the astral level. Before you immediately dismiss that as a possibility, consider that our souls do not look like our physical bodies and resemble more like an egg of translucent white light. Also, our sun is actually white light, but the intensity of its light and color can be diluted or changed due to the refraction of the waves' rays through the Earth's atmosphere. Also, our bodies will no longer have eyes with rods and cones anymore because souls see with the central core of their being on the other side. So maybe the sun's light would appear more pure, and also consider the light could be the essence or soul of our sun. Marta M. said, quote, all of a sudden, and I looked up, I saw light. Now, I don't know if it was the spiritual plane or the sun, end quote. Maria T.K. said, they asked her if she saw an unearthly light, and she said, yes. The light was exactly like the center of the sun, end quote. Jody said, I was taken to a sun behind our sun, where dwells the light of Alpha and Omega, end quote. I'm going to interject here and say I got an email the other day from someone who said during their near-death experience that they were taken to Sirius and that the white light is Sirius, and the Sirius is basically the sun that feeds our sun. And so I wrote him back and I asked him, well, you know, how do you know this was serious? You know, were you told that when you were there, or did you just know it because you were one with the light, or, you know, was it something you learned after, you know, something you came to believe after you came back? And he wrote back and he said, well, because he was watching these videos on YouTube and it all just made sense. And so, you know, you got to be very careful with, in my opinion, with when people say things as if it's factual. It could still be colored by their opinions, and I don't know. I just got to be very careful with that. So the light on the other side, it's luminescent, and often the light beings are said to be glowing, and there's a feeling of oneness and of love and a euphoria, and they know this complete knowledge, and they also say that the light over there is a collective soul, which hopefully we'll get into later. On the topic of love, Nicole B.D. said, quote, the most amazing part was a pure feeling of the most intense love I can barely describe. It was just wave after wave of pure love. It was within me. It was around me. It was everything. It felt like heartbeats of love, one wave of love after another. Yet there was love in the interim as well. Then the wave would come with even more and more. It was endless, eternal, and complete. I had no fear whatsoever. I had no feeling other than love. I had no thought other than reaching the light. I felt pure happiness and joy. It was the most beautiful feeling that words could never even come close to describing. The closest thing I can think of to relate it to on this earth would be the moment I brought my child into this world. That moment of pure, unconditional love that I'm sure most mothers and some fathers have felt. End quote. Now, love is a word that means so many different things here on Earth, and it's used as sort of an all-encompassing umbrella term. And if we take a truthful, introspective look at our relationships, we too often will uncover a selfish motivation for being with that person. And the kind of love we should strive for is an altruistic one, like giving food to a homeless person, being careful not to enable them or make them dependent, but love can make us vulnerable and dependent on someone, so we should be careful not to spoil someone to the point where they become lazy or use us. We are told it is wrong for us to cause suffering for another human being, right? But I guess it's okay for God to make us suffer. Suffering is not the only way to teach love, in my opinion. Your empathy for another being, suffering is not the feeling of love, but the recognition of another human being going through suffering, which makes no sense whatsoever. In fact, near-death experiencers say love is all there is on the other side. One near-death experiencer said he had to look up the definition of the word hate when he came back because it didn't exist on the other side. So why would we need to come to Earth to learn to love when it's so readily abundant there? It's our soul's natural state. I guess since they consider it's a collective soul, and they, you know, soldiers sent here on a mission, which is very rarely told to them, but then they bring back this knowledge, and, you know, they collectively maybe can process it and gain wisdom from it. So maybe from that respect, there could be, I suppose, a reason for it all. But on the topic of euphoria, Gene Jay said, perhaps it was a euphoric trance of some kind. It was as if a spirit had consumed my whole being. I felt as if I had automatically become super holy. I almost felt like I became all-knowing of everything once again. I had no questions because I knew all the answers. I was feeling godlike and powerful. I felt like I had a direct connection to the powers that heal. I couldn't even believe the way I was feeling, but for some reason it all seemed to come together. End quote. Near-death experiences almost universally describe a blissful euphoria or an ecstasy associated with this loving being of light. And is it possible that the euphoria is a false sense? Here on Earth, we have drugs that can generate states of ecstasy. In fact, most people know the drug MDMA is ecstasy because of the blissful states of ecstasy and euphoria that it generates. And it's also earned the nickname the love drug. MDMA causes the brain to release oxytocin, which is the human hormone linked to feelings of love and compassion. The short-term effects of it include euphoria, a sense of general well-being and happiness, increased sociability and feelings of communication being easy or simple, self-confidence, increased empathy or feelings of closeness with others, a sense of inner peace, false sense of affection, knowledge and wisdom and learning. I guess that's another topic I want to talk about. I hate to jump from topic one to another so fast, but my notes aren't the greatest. Carol V said, I experienced light beings who were knowledge and gave me answers to all the questions of the universe. Universal truth and knowledge, end quote. So near-death experiencers say we come back to learn more, to gain more knowledge, yet they claim all knowledge and wisdom of everything is present or available in the light. So what would be the need, once again, to come back to Earth to learn? Are we to believe our souls were created as blank slates or something, or that they were created incomplete, flawed, or defective, and the only way to gain wisdom is by incarnating here? I think that's preposterous. Jesus said, "Ye are gods." And if we have that divine spark inside of us, that divine light within, then it doesn't make sense to me that we would need to incarnate here for thousands of years to learn lessons that we already know. And if we are to learn through pain and suffering, then why is it oftentimes so random? And if we have no memory of a past discretion from a previous life, then how can we know what we are being punished for? And therefore, how can we learn? Granted, perhaps the soul will remember once we die, but while we are here on Earth, it really seems like an inefficient and crappy situation. I don't understand why we don't have any knowledge whatsoever that this is a school or a test for us to grow and learn. After all, we are fully aware when we enroll at a university here that we are to learn and will be tested. Even if that was the only thing we remembered before coming to Earth, the lessons would still be difficult. I mean, have you ever tried to deal with a difficult person? Even when you're trying your very best to act in a spiritual manner, it is still very hard. There's this idea of oneness that near-death experiencers consistently report. It's a major component of the near-death experience, seems to be a feeling of interconnectedness with everything or a oneness with the universe. Some mention being part of a collective soul. This feeling of oneness is sometimes reported here on Earth with certain psychotropic drugs like mushrooms or LSD. And here on Earth in the physical plane, everything is so much more dense. And in the astral plane, the medium, the liquid light or plasma, the most abundant matter in the universe, is more fluid, less solid, thinner, or quicker. Plasma is one of the best conductors and a much better conductor than air, which is a very poor conductor. In fact, air is an excellent insulator. Since everything is vibrating more quicker to a higher frequency, maybe that allows for quicker transfer of everything. So compared to what we are used to here, maybe it gives the illusion or sensation of everything being interconnected. The collective is a fascinating concept. Interesting that it occurs in some insects as a hive mind. The problem with the collective is that if the collective decides that you should go on a mission for the greater good, you basically no longer have any free will of your own. You're just a puppet keeping your own, you know, keeping your own sovereignty and not becoming part of any hierarchy seems preferential to me. We can still collaborate with each other in cooperation versus the bored collective of a hive mind bound to do the will of the whole versus any independent free thought. It's like you're plugged into the holistic knowledge. That's pretty scary when you think about it. The lure for them is the euphoria of a combined energy, the love drug. Drugs like opium, heroin, and ecstasy can leave their users like spaced out junkies. I think what one would give up by going into the light would be their free will or freedom and unique individuality or soul in exchange for slavery to what the collective decides. One other thing I want to mention that I just happened to think of is I've talked to a couple people at IONS, which is where near-death experiencers go to meetings every month to discuss their experiences. And I've couple of them mentioned that they didn't go through the tunnel and they never went into the light, but yet they still felt the love that the near-death experiencers talk about. So I think it's the exhilaration from just being free from your body and not being stuck in this physical prison any longer that gives you this feeling of freedom and love. And I don't necessarily think you have to go to the light to get that. On the topic of merging with the light, it's an interesting one, as I've had the feeling that at death, this being light may be absorbing the light energy from the souls and sending the souls back to Earth into another body with just enough light energy to sustain itself. You lose your identity. It's kind of reminiscent of the Borg collective in Star Trek. On the meaning or purpose of life, I'm going to skip over that for the moment. And on Jesus and God, while reading through some of the near-death experiences mentioning Jesus, I noticed several contradictions. It's ironic since near-death experiencers claim to have such complete and total knowledge, but a few said Jesus had brown hair, while a couple said he had white hair. A few said he had blue eyes, while a few said he had brown eyes. A couple who identified Jesus and God as the same identity, while others clearly thought of them as different personages. One said Jesus died on the cross, and another said he didn't. It's just part of the contradictions. There's a ton of them when you look at them and their full body of work. On the face of God, I did a search on the site for face of God to see if what people reported, and almost all of them, I'd say over 90 or 95%, couldn't see a face because the light was shining so brightly from this being they identified with God. But of the few that did identify a face, it's very interesting. Charles M. said, quote, "I observed him as he was so surely to hold onto the doorknob of this particular room door as he came out backwards and noticed his countenance having what appeared to be a long robe on which you could clearly look through him, and the gold belt he had on, plus looking at his face, which scared the living crap out of me. He had the face of a lion." End quote. Patricia A.R. said, "I looked at the throne and I was light, and the face of a bear, eagle, lion, and ram, all changing every second." End quote. John S. said, "Back to the pearly gates. He came to me and I said, 'Hey man, you got wings.' He smiled at me. I asked him what was pinning me, and that was really tough. He told me not to look at it, but I did for a second. I had to turn away. He was fearsome, had a few faces, some kind of lion, eagle, and such. My feeling was that it was the guard to the entrance of heaven," end quote. Yeah, I don't think that one wasn't, he wasn't claiming it was God. He just happened to notice. You know, it's funny when Jeff Long actually went on the Art Bell radio show to talk about near-death experiences, and they went to calls. They got a call from someone who said the exact same thing, that during their near-death experience, they saw these beings with a face of a lion. I think it was somewhere around the pearly gates, too. Maybe it was the same guy. Who knows? Anyway, there's this one account which was labeled as an STE, a spiritually transformative experience, but it had most the same elements of an advanced NDE. had the light, the love, and the telepathic communication with beings. I asked him, what emotions did you feel during the experience? And he said, or I guess it was she, Mary D., she said, immense love. I saw a beam of white. It came out of the sky and touched me on the shoulder. And she said, one responding to my unasked question, who are you? They said, the God of Abraham, end quote. There you go, the God of Abraham. That's Yahweh, folks. That's quite possibly the being of light that's judging everyone, sending them back to earth and acting so loving-like. But yet, you know, when they ask these beings, who are you? And they say, the God of Abraham, which is Yahweh. And from our history and in the Bible, you know, Yahweh is the God of pestilence. He's not a nice guy. There's this guy named Israel on the Near-Death Experiences Research Foundation site. It's a guy who says an angel named Landiel explained to him the evolution of our planet, that this wonderful evolution means all humans are going to be bound within some super being. And said, who is that giant spirit? I felt as if my heart were racing, although I was in my astral body. The angel smiled and slowly answered my question. It is going to be a strong, huge, high-intensity spirit from the third level of existence, from the forces level. That spirit is going to bond himself with all of humanity on the planet Earth. It will create a huge new entity, one that will improve your lives tremendously and forever. This huge spirit is quite well known to humanity on Earth. Many people, unknowingly, already are craving to bond with him. They consciously pray for his help and love him. In some part of their subconscious minds, all people on Earth already know it. And whether they believe in any established religion or not, in times of great need, most humans recognize his existence. They call him God, Elohim, Yahweh, Allah, the Heavenly Father, and many other names, end quote. That's what Israel said, this guy named Israel said on the NDERF website about this being who's an angel explaining to him the evolution of the planet and that it's going to evolve into a god who he identifies with as Yahweh or Allah. Anyway, these two accounts mention the God of the near-death experience light being the same as the God of Abraham or Yahweh. It's very telling, in my opinion. The God of the Old Testament was full of hate and destruction. And the fact that these beings in the light sure identified themselves as Yahweh, archangels, Mary, and other Old Testament characters shows they are still up to their old tricks, manipulating and controlling souls. Angels. In addition to the many cases of meeting Jesus, there are almost 100 cases where an archangel, a biblical figure such as Virgin Mary, or a guardian angel or spirit guide was encountered. That doesn't include all the cases where an unidentified angel was seen. But here's the breakdown. Michael, there are 7 cases. Gabriel, 3 cases. Raphael, 3 cases. Metatron, 2 cases. The angel of death, 2 cases. An unnamed archangel, 3 cases. Virgin Mary, 21 cases. Ascended Master, 2 cases. Spirit guide, 12 cases. Guardian angel, about 50 cases. There's also over 40 cases with hooded beings with robes. Usually the face could not be seen. I want to mention a friend who I correspond with in the UK. He's part of a healing circle who channels the Archangel Michael and others, and he has related many stories of the leader being attacked psychically, hospitalized, and the highly unusual physical manifestation of insects in her home, which can't be fumigated. And when he asked the source through the leader whether humanity will awaken in time to stop the secret societies, the source told him there was no conspiracy. Anyway, on to aliens. About 36 near-death accounts with aliens on NDERF.org. There are many parallels between the near-death experience and the alien abduction experience. Both experiences are taken up into a light, since the aliens usually take up the abductee into the light of a tractor beam emanating from a ship. Communication is telepathic or empathic in both cases. Oftentimes, the abductee will be made to feel intense love, as researchers such as David Jacobs say they can control our thoughts and actions. David Jacobs said, they can make us love them and hate them. End quote. The aliens are said to be interested in us as containers for the soul, and the aliens are said to be able to place screen memories as an overlay to mask or hide the real experience so that the abductee will either forget the entire experience or remember false memories. That bit about the aliens seeing us as containers for the soul, first I ever heard any UFO researcher talk about matters of the spirit or soul was when John Lear mentioned that we were containers for the soul. So I want to give props to John Lear. He also was the one on Art Bell's show who said that the light was a trick and got me thinking I need to research this phenomenon a little deeper and see if it's possible. Anyway, Ruth on Ender said, I was taken to special entities who looked like the usual grays, but they had lots of wrinkles on their faces. They called themselves the Council and said they were part of a group called Soul Recyclers, helping souls to reincarnate, end quote. Back to the meaning of life. So what's the meaning of life? Interestingly enough, NDEers do not unanimously agree on the answer. A few mention love as the meaning, while others say it is to learn lessons. Of course, these lessons could have to do with love, but it seems like most are given a mission. They're told that they have a mission that they got to go back and complete, but yet they're virtually never told what that mission is. There's a life review, a judgment of sorts, sometimes in front of a council, but I think being told you have to go back is kind of a judgment in itself. I want to talk about the topic of soul contracts, and it's a very important one as it seems they need our consent, and we have to willingly agree to a contract before coming to Earth. And I have a friend who had an extensive NDE and literally met the Demiurge on his way back to Earth. He was somewhere around the moon, he said, and he had to agree to a contract before being allowed to come back. Contract was consisted of a series of if-then-else statements. And if everything goes according to plan, you get plan A, point one, point A. Otherwise, you don't keep your part of the deal, and others who are contracted don't keep their agreements. You could end up with plan Q, point seven, point J. You know, he said you eventually souls refuse to reincarnate anymore, and the Demiurge gives up, and the Earth has thousands of years of a peaceful paradise. At death, that is once our silver cord has been severed, our contract should no longer apply, and they will need to convince us to take on a new contract. So they'll try to convince us that we need to learn more and that it's necessary. We should also terminate any contracts we currently have, as they were formed under lies and deception and thus null and void. Or at least we should try to terminate them. I don't know. Who knows if we're stuck with them, if we've agreed to it. One thing I'd like to mention is that I have started receiving messages from people who seem borderline suicidal. I guess my message that Earth is a prison and there's a better realm attracts certain individuals to my theory, but I in no way condone suicide, and what I believe is just a theory and could very well be wrong, and yes, I base my belief on evidence, but it's far from conclusive and it's still speculation. If I am wrong, then they could use that argument against you. I mean, they could use that against you, and you would have to come back and take this whole lesson over again. And to take the shortcut would not be considered unless you still have not awakened, as you do not want to do any single act that could jeopardize your chance of freedom. Plus, we're learning new things every day and may conceive of a better escape strategy. If this is a movie and we're all heroes of the movie, then why would you want to abort the mission? I mean, how would you like it if all the heroes in the movies you watch just gave up halfway through and killed themselves? We need to keep the vibrational level of our soul as high as possible, or we may not be able to go to the higher realm and stay there. I don't say these things to generate fear or depression, but rather to empower people. So there's that. Coming back against will or with persuasion. Near-death experiencers often say they were told they had to go back to Earth because they had a mission that they haven't fulfilled yet. The vast majority, maybe as much as 90% in my opinion, are never told what that mission is before they're sent back. Sometimes they are told they will know when the time is right or that they will receive help. It seems a little dubious to me that we are sent back, often against our will, to do an undisclosed mission. I mean, what mission could a god possibly have or need us to do? I mean, Doesn't make any sense to me. Archons are shape-shifting entities, and these could be examples of NDEs with Archons. And if so, are all NDEs encounters with Archons? It's possible, if they access the Akashic records, that they could simulate any person who has lived or appears them, and thus convince the soul to go back to Earth. At least a dozen accounts where the aliens shapeshift to or make the NDE comfortable. Robert B. said, quote, I saw the light approach. I was enveloped by the light in an entity that was to prepare for me what I call my interview with a supreme being later in the light. This first being appeared to be the Virgin Mary. Only after asking, are you truly the Virgin Mary, it instantly manifested true identity. I was nearly paralyzed with fear until again asking, please, what is happening to me? What is going on here? End quote. There's lots of tricks and traps that they mention in their experiences. Private Doubting said, at last, light is seen ahead. It's not the light of heaven. It is the lure of hell. End quote. Janet P., they asked her if she saw light. She said, no. They said, describe. She said, beyond that, that's a false projection. End quote. James S. said, I looked up at my benefactors and found that they were dressed in black gowns and had a screen over their faces, which if you look closely at, had a mirror-like substance that reflected your own image back at you. End quote. That was something I speculated once upon a time, and later I found that quote. Anyway, Gunter W. said, quote, then something happened that I would never forget. Love, pure, utter love, came pouring down on me along with incredible warmth. My whole soul or being was immersed in this love. Gradually, the loving became weaker, and I felt that something was wrong with me, something that made it very difficult for the light to continue with his love. Finally, however, he was not able to keep it up any longer, and he quickly said, you have a smelly breath, and you need a bath. I received the impression that I would have to take a bath similar to that I was used to on Earth, but by dipping the whole body. It was made plain to me that this process was going to be unpleasant, but I could stop it when it became too painful for me to bear. I thought to myself, this scoundrel of a voice, he has betrayed me by forcing me into this world. There is no way back. This is final. End quote. Some inconsistencies. Some say there's no hell or evil, while others were shown hell and evil and say they know it exists. The vast majority say we judge ourselves, while others were clearly judged by God or a council of beings in courtrooms. One person said they knew or learned there was no reincarnation, while many others learned of multiple lives they had lived. Most say we have free will, yet many were literally forced to come back to Earth against their will. Others were shown specific events in the future of the Earth or their own lives. One said he was showed what would happen to his family members if he chose to come back, and also what would happen if he chose not to come back. If the future is known, do we really have total free will? An overwhelming number of near-death experiencers talk about the light as being loving and their experience in the light as being positive. It may very well be that we are all part of a collective soul, which we call God. We come here to Earth in order to learn and grow, and we take that knowledge back to the collective, where we all have access to that pooled knowledge and wisdom. There may be no way out of the system, and eventually we all have to return to the light and aren't allowed to participate in a better world until we have matured to a point that we can play well with others. That is why it's absolutely necessary to work on ourselves spiritually so we can graduate if this is indeed a school. But I'm convinced that there's no reason for us to have to learn anything. It just does not make any sense. Anyway, however, I think there's also some evidence to suggest there might be something nefarious going on. Personally, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting not to go to the light and choosing instead to rely on one's own sovereignty. So we get to the solution. And essentially, everything is energy, which consists of higher and lower octaves of vibration or frequency. The brilliant scientist Nikola Tesla said, quote, if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration, end quote. So you have these dimensional octaves, and what I would say the solution is your willful ascension to the purest light. And that's really going within or going inside of yourself, because frequencies as they get higher, that just means the wavelength is getting shorter, so you're actually going within. So if near-death experiences are correct, then when we die, we can create our own reality and can travel by thought or intent. Unfortunately, other entities may try to usurp our sovereignty or free will and trick us into doing their will and willingly give them our energy. One could decide to go to darkness or a void and stop relying on external sources and rely on one's own inner light to manifest reality. This could be disastrous if one's thoughts and desires are not pure. One could potentially become another demiurge if you start manifesting reality. If you enjoy life on Earth in a physical body, as some people here claim, then you can choose to go to the light and reincarnate again with your friends. There are many trappings here on Earth that are tempting, and the challenge of overcoming obstacles to forge the life you want can be inviting. You can request a better planet or a better situation in your deal with the demiurge. You could also refuse to come unless you are guaranteed 100% certainty of events. My friend who had an NDE and met the demiurge said eventually the demiurge gives up, and there are thousands of years of paradise on Earth, so you could refuse to reincarnate until that time. If you're tired of the unending drama that a life on Earth in a physical body presents, then you can dissolve your attachments and ties to this world. To do this, it may be necessary to learn not to judge others or hold grudges or anger toward others. It may also be important to not give others the incentive to hold grudges against you, which may hold the spirit back. To do this, it might be helpful for one to renounce the world and all its physical lures. If one is ready to move on and leave all the drama of the lower planes behind, then here is the solution I prefer. Because believe you me, I'm tired of all the drama, and I want to go become like maybe being a pure energy. Anyway, there are those who say to go to the black hole at the center of the galaxy or return to Orion, but I disagree with that. I agree with what Tesla said, and I believe the universe is composed of octaves. In my opinion, one needs to leave the physical and astral planes behind completely. So my suggestion is, at death, one can raise the vibrational level or frequency of the soul, which is light. Just keep increasing the vibration of your soul as much as you possibly can by using your focused, willful intent. This means ignoring any distractions that try to lure you to a light or any attractive being, whether angel or family member, etc. You will eventually arrive at what the Gnostics call the eternal light realms, or the height of heights, the light of lights. This should be our soul's natural, original state, but just keep increasing your soul's vibration or frequency until you arrive at the highest frequency, which may manifest as the purest light, the absolute truth, and unconditional love. One thing we should strive towards is, you know, eliminate all your attachments to this physical realm. And as the Gnostics say, they say, be loving unto men, be ye gentle, be ye peacemakers, be ye merciful, be ye compassionate, be ye loving unto God or Source, be ye righteous, minister unto the poor and sick and afflicted, renounce everything. I find this one's very important. Basically, it means every single situation on Earth is caused by the illusion of the demiurge. None of it's real, so form no attachments to those things that are material. No one knows the God of truth except solely the man who will forsake all the things of the world, having renounced the whole place and having grasped the fringe of his garment. We are to renounce all things of the world, including murmuring, eavesdropping, litigiousness, false slander, false witness, pride and haughtiness, belly love, babbling, craftiness, avarice, love of the world, pillage, evil conversation, wickedness, pitilessness, wrath, cursing, thieving, robbery, slandering, fighting and strife, all unknowing, evil doing, sloth, adultery, murder, impiety, atheism, magic potions, blasphemy, and doctrines of error. But that should come natural, I think. Anyway, that's what I have to give you this update. So good night, sleep tight, and don't let the archons bite.